See it as an absolute necessity.
The Kitchen Cabinet with Jay Rayner.
This isn't really just a food question. This is also relationship advice.
Returns tomorrow morning at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Yum, yum, hubba, hubba.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 14th of November. This is Today with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
Good morning, the headlines today. Donald Trump has yet to respond to the BBC's apology to him, but its refusal to pay compensation for a misleading edit of one of his speeches. We'll be asking where this standoff goes next and where it leaves accusations of institutional bias in the corporation. The Culture Secretary will join us at 10 past eight. Resident doctors in England are beginning a five-day strike this morning in their long-running dispute over pay. What pressure will this put on hospitals and where will the impact of the strikes be felt most? We'll hear from NHS England and the British Medical Association.
Also in today's programme, we followed the story of the British-Egyptian pro-democracy activist Alaa Abd El Fattah throughout his imprisonment in Egypt, all the way through to his release 2 months ago. Well, now his family say he's being blocked from travelling back to the UK. His sister joins us live after 8 o'clock. Robo-taxis, self-driving cars to you and me, hit the highways in the US. So we've put one to the test.
Heading to Daly City, City Hall. Please make sure your seatbelt is fastened.
And it's a Saturday night institution across the pond. NBC's Saturday Night Live has made countless household names and it's coming to the UK next year. Its top creative team has just been announced, so will the format translate over here? We'll find out. Before all of that, though, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
There's been no response so far from President Trump after the BBC apologised to him for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches, but rejected his demand for compensation. In a statement last night, the BBC said the edit in a Panorama documentary had given the impression that he'd called for violence after losing the presidency to Joe Biden 5 years ago. It's written to Mr. Trump and his lawyers, who've threatened a $1 billion lawsuit. Here's our media editor, Katie Razzle.
Two letters, an apology, and a promise not to broadcast the Panorama again. But the BBC has told the president it will not be paying him compensation for editing together sections of a speech he made on the day of the Capitol Hill riots in January 2021. The corporation pointed out to the president's legal team Donald Trump didn't suffer any harm as a result of the Panorama. He was elected president soon after it was broadcast. The BBC is also examining a report that in 2022, an edition of Newsnight ran a similarly edited version of the speech. This new revelation prompted an accusation from the president's legal team of a pattern of defamation by the BBC. The corporation said it rejected this.
The Conservatives have called for a review of processes and procedures at the BBC, saying licence fee payers should not have to pay the price for poor editorial decisions. The Liberal Democrats have called on the Prime Minister to get on the phone to President Trump to stop him suing the corporation. The Department for Culture, Media and Sport has not commented. Resident doctors in England are beginning a five-day walkout this morning, their second strike this year in a dispute over pay. NHS bosses have said frontline staff or services may have to be cut because of the financial impact. The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, has dismissed the warning as emotional blackmail. Our health editor Hugh Pym has the details.
Trusts will redeploy senior doctors to prioritise emergency services. Employers say that the cost of the action, up to £300 million, and similar to the previous strike, is not covered by the government, so will pile more pressure on constrained budgets and could lead to service cuts. The BMA said that the government could stop the strike with a new offer on jobs and on pay, compensating for past inflation. But ministers say doctors have had a nearly 29% increase over 3 years, and that an offer of help on medical costs and a commitment to more jobs for newly qualified doctors was turned down.
The government will announce a significant shake-up of the asylum system on Monday. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, is expected to tell MPs that successful asylum seekers will only be allowed to stay in the UK temporarily. Some of the measures are modelled on the Danish system, seen as one of the toughest in Europe. Here's our political correspondent, Georgia Roberts.
The Home Secretary is likely to declare that the era of permanent protection is over. There will be two key objectives to these reforms: removing the incentives that draw illegal migrants to Britain and increasing removals and deportations. Imitating Denmark's approach to asylum, Shabana Mahmood is also expected to say that only temporary stay will be granted to successful asylum seekers. When their home country is deemed safe, they will be returned. The Home Office has published figures claiming nearly 50,000 illegal migrants have been removed or deported from the UK since Labour entered power.
Emergency services in Ukraine say a Russian missile and drone attack on the capital Kyiv overnight has killed one person and wounded 15 others. The mayor of the city, Vitaly Klitschko, said debris from a drone had hit a five-storey residential building. Council leaders are urging the government not to duck reforms to the special educational needs system in England, which they say is facing total collapse. The County Council's network says rising demand will leave local authorities with a £4.4 billion annual deficit by the end of this parliament. The government has delayed planned changes until next year, saying it wants to get them right. Alex Forsyth reports.
It's widely accepted that the special educational needs and disability system is buckling. With rising demand, parents often having to battle for support and budgets under huge strain. Council leaders in England are calling for billions in funding deficits to be written off, investment in specialist provision in mainstream schools, and changes to education, health and care plans, the legal documents that underpin a child's right to support. The Department for Education said the government had already made progress with funding for more specialist school places and early intervention, and was listening to families and would continue engaging with parents.
The ban on landlords evicting tenants in England without providing a reason will come into force in 6 months' time. It's one of the changes brought in by the Renters' Rights Act, which became law last month. Landlord groups say they're concerned that the court system will be too slow if things go wrong. Our housing reporter Tara Welsh has more details.
Renters groups have for years been calling for a ban on Section 21 notices. They allow landlords to evict a tenant with just 8 weeks' notice without giving a reason. From the 1st of May, there'll be a number of sweeping changes. Rental bidding wars will be made illegal. Landlords will only be able to increase rents once a year, and tenants will have the right to request a pet. But one of the biggest changes will be that tenancies will no longer have fixed terms. They'll be ongoing. The government says landlords will still be able to evict tenants under certain circumstances.
The billionaire Jeff Bezos's space company Blue Origin has successfully launched a rocket on its first flight for a paying customer. The giant New Glenn rocket was carrying two NASA satellites bound for Mars. The launch from Florida represents a major step forward for Blue Origin in another way too. The booster rocket touched down safely in the Atlantic, allowing it to be used again.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. 7 minutes past six now. Let's check the weather because there are storms afoot, Simon King.
Yeah, absolutely, Anna. It's not a great start to the day. We've got some heavy rain right across England and Wales already this morning. This is all because of Storm Claudia, and we've got some amber warnings from the Met Office. Let's talk about generally England and Wales today, because that rain is going to continue pretty much all day. Those amber warnings are in force from midday for parts of South East Wales, East Wales, the Midlands and eastern parts of England. We could see easily half to the whole month worth of rain falling in the space of the next 24 hours. The far southeast of England, it will turn a bit drier here. There'll be some sunny spells developing around Kent and East Sussex into the afternoon. There'll also be a fairly brisk east or southeasterly wind as well, especially to the west of the Pennines, northwest Wales, gusts of 60, 70 miles an hour. But all this rainfall, of course, could well lead to some flooding, especially in those areas where the amber warning is going to be in force. Now, for Northern Ireland, it's quite cloudy this morning, some rain, but that's going to clear. There'll be some sunny spells this afternoon, maximum temperatures of 7 to 9 degrees. And for Scotland, it's a chilly start to the day. We've got a frost actually in northern Scotland. Clear skies here, so lots of sunshine today. In southern Scotland, it's quite cloudy at the moment. There'll be some rain at times through this morning, but it will turn a bit brighter as we go into the afternoon, with maximum temperatures of about 4 to 6 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Financial Times' main story online suggests that the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has ditched plans to increase income tax in this month's budget. The report
quotes unnamed officials who say the idea, which contradicts a Labour manifesto pledge, has been shelved due to fears it would anger voters. Now, the BBC has not yet confirmed that story, but we will be talking to our political correspondent, Harry Farley, at 6:30 about what it all means.
The Guardian this morning leads on the BBC's apology to President Trump for that edited video clip on Panorama and its rejection. This is the BBC's rejection of President Trump's demands for compensation for that. The corporation has been advised it has a strong legal case, according to the paper, which also notes that it remains to be seen how Donald Trump will respond to that.
It is expected that the president is giving an interview to GB News later today. The eye focuses on the changes to UK immigration law due to be announced next week by the Home Secretary. The paper says Shabana Mahmood is seeking to change European human rights laws, specifically migrants' use of Article 8, the right to family life, to halt their deportation. The new model is based on Danish laws, with the report noting that 95% of failed asylum seekers into Denmark are then deported.
Andrew New, Epstein abused girls, reads the Daily Mirror's headline this morning. The paper leads on the thousands of documents released by US lawmakers that are related to the convicted sex offender, including testimony from the former prince's accuser, Virginia Giuffre. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has always denied knowledge of or involvement in Epstein's crimes.
The Daily Mail leads on a report into the murder of the 10-year-old schoolgirl Sara Sharif. It said officials were scared to speak out due to fears they'd be seen as racist. The Express also highlights the story. Sara failed by officials afraid to cause offence, reads its headline. We'll be speaking to England's Children's Commissioner later in the programme.
And animal rights campaigners are warning that hundreds of pigs in the New Forest are under siege from, well, what are described as smartphone brandishing piggy tourists. This is according to a report in the Times this morning. The paper quotes one campaigner who's criticised local businesses for encouraging people to form crowds and chase and photograph the wild pigs when they come out to feed.
Piggy tourists.
Who knows? Who knows? It's always, I suppose it's all about what you film nowadays, isn't it? And the pictures you can take and pop them up on social media. Just a brief look through the front pages for you this morning then. It is 6:11 now.
Let's turn to what is happening overnight in Ukraine. Almost every district in Kyiv came under what the city's mayor has described as a massive attack. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landell is in the Ukrainian capital. An uncomfortable night for many, I suspect, James.
Yes, it was a bit of a noisy night. Clearly the most severe attack on the capital for several weeks. It's been unusually quiet, and so everybody, I think, was expecting this at some stage. As you say, it is definitely a citywide attack. You know, overnight explosions could be seen and heard across the night sky. But also we heard the sounds of drones and missiles flying directly above us here in the centre of the city. The emergency services say there's damage reported in at least 9 districts across the city, with a lot of the social media images overnight posted showing direct hits on a lot of high-rise apartments. There's reports of damage to a school and a hospital, a lot of fires. So far, reports, as ever, of those killed and wounded is moving, but there's been a report of at least one person killed and 24 wounded, some of them quite severe. So definitely, after several weeks of most of the Russian focus being on Ukrainian energy networks in the east of the country, a night of targeting the capital.
And as if that wasn't enough for President Zelensky to manage, he has a major corruption scandal on his hands.
Yeah, no, he does. And I don't think we've seen the end of it yet. Essentially, the allegations are by the prosecutors that of a massive kickback scheme at the heart of the government. Two ministers have been told to resign already. Two businessmen, one of them who is a very close associate of President Zelensky, have had financial sanctions imposed on them and travel bans. They've already left the country. Essentially, the allegation is that there was a group of senior officials and ministers who were creaming off cash from government contracts, in particular those contracts focused on creating protections and defences for Ukraine's energy network, and in particular its nuclear power plants. there are two schools of thought. Some, as the government is saying, look, this shows that Ukraine is a mature democracy, that a judicial process is working, that the anti-corruption mechanism is going fine. Others are saying, this is hugely embarrassing and is causing substantial anger across the country, because there are people at the moment here in Ukraine living in the dark, in the cold, because of the power cuts, sometimes we're up to 16 hours a night. And the idea that this energy that is not coming to them as a result of these Russian attacks has been less protected because of alleged corruption in the capital has caused some upset. So at the moment, the government is rushing to try and put a lid on this, but I think public trust is at risk of being substantially damaged by this corruption scandal.
James Landell in Kyiv, thank you.
It's 6:15. The special educational needs and disability system faces total collapse, according to council leaders. Alex Forsyth is our political correspondent. Morning, Alex. Where's this warning coming from?
Yeah, well, morning, Anna. If you talk to parents who try to navigate this system on behalf of their children, they'll tell you they already know that it's really challenging. They've often got to fight for support. The provision's often patchy or inadequate. But the warning today specifically is coming from the County Councils Network, which is a body that represents some of England's biggest local authorities. And they're really focusing on the pressure of finances, saying that it's becoming unsustainable because councils have been building up debt in providing support for some time. Now, due to the accounting system, that's kept off the books, but they're accruing in the background that deficit, and they say it's going to reach £4.4 billion a year by the end of this parliament. So they're really calling on the government to do something about this, to come up with a plan.
It is a plan, because we talk about this regularly on the programme and the idea of reform and how it should look in the future. Is it something that the government is considering already?
Yeah, ministers are really conscious this system's under strain, and they've promised they are going to reform it, but that those reforms have now been delayed until next year. Now, we know that the government supports the idea of more inclusive mainstream schools with specialist provision and early intervention, but this is challenging because more mainstream provision would mean significant extra resources for schools. There is this question over education, health and care plans. That's the legal document that underpins a family's right to support. Plenty of campaigners say don't water those down. Then there's this question of the deficits councils are building up. They want those written off, but of course the context is the budget on the horizon when we're told about the pressure on public finances. And there are Labour MPs saying don't make this about spending cuts, it's got to be about families. Now, I'm told by Labour MPs they get the sense that ministers are listening to them. I suspect they're mindful of what happened with the backlash over welfare reform. And the government says it's out there engaging with families and parents, and it will keep doing that. But there is no doubt this is challenging, and it is an area the government can't really afford to get this wrong, not least because the impact it has on so many families.
Alex Forsyth, our political correspondent, thank you.
It is 17 minutes past six. Will's here with the business news. Lots more speculation about the budget, Will, but also the property website Rightmove facing £1 billion legal action over what many estate agents who are part of the claim believe are unfair fees.
Yeah, that's right. Morning, Nick. Morning, Anna. And yes, plenty, isn't there, as you guys were discussing in the paper review of budget speculation, which we will come to in a moment. But Rightmove had a bumpy time with its shares recently too, and now facing, as you say, potentially this claim on behalf of estate agents who are claiming that the Rightmove has abused its dominant market position and charged excessive and unfair fees for those listing properties on its site. Rightmove, in response, has said it's received note of a potential claim and that it's confident in the value it provides to its partners. Well, Tom Smith is with us, partner at Gerardine Partners and former legal director at the Competition and Markets Authority. Tom, morning.
Morning, Will.
So this is the fees that estate agents pay to have their properties listed on Rightmove. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So Rightmove is seen as a kind of must-have if you're an estate agent. And the allegation is that they're abusing that position by charging very high and frequently increasing fees.
Right. And is it that movement in it that is the kind of the central tension here? If there were fees and everybody knew what they were signing up to, not a problem. Is it that the fees change that this legal case is going to argue is the problem?
Both. So the law is that if you're charging, it's kind of called price gouging, or if you're an economist, you call it extracting monopoly rents. It's excessive and unfair prices. So it could just be that it's very, very high and stays the same, or it could also be that it's increasing. They seem to be alleging both here.
And presumably Rightmove will point to other Zoopla and other places, and presumably these estate agents' own websites, and say, well, you do have other options to go to other places if you don't like the fees we charge.
Yeah, so the Rightmove seems to have an 80% market share for this stuff. So I think estate agents would say they have to go with Rightmove, whether they like it or not. They may go with another portal as well, but they have to go with Rightmove.
Yeah, that's an important stat, isn't it? But your former colleagues at the CMA haven't seen fit to, haven't seen that as a concern, haven't investigated. This hasn't been subject of that 80%, that market position has never been the centre of a CMA action thus far either, though, has it?
No, it hasn't. Yeah, so you have the kind of public authority enforcement by the CMA, but you also have private enforcement. And if you want to get compensation, if you think you've been harmed by someone, by a company's breach of competition law, going down the private enforcement in the courts route is the only way to get compensation.
I mean, what's your sense that language that's been used in this case, dominant market position? I mean, it's going to centre around that, isn't it? I mean, 80% sounds certainly a strong position. What's your take?
Yeah, it's quite a common ground of action in competition law cases. Apple, for example, was found a couple of weeks ago to have overcharged UK consumers by 1.5 billion. So you often get, you know, big fees, big kind of sums when you have these kind of big markets across the economy.
And so what are the next steps, presumably, with all legal cases? It's not quick.
No, it won't be quick, no. And I suppose unless the case settles, but the case could take years.
Right. Tom, thanks so much for your time this morning. Tom Smith, their partner at Gerardine Partners and a former legal director at the Competition and Markets Authority. Well, alongside me in the studio this morning is Zaina Bain, managing partner at Sullivan Street Partners. Morning, Zaina.
Morning, Will.
And I mentioned in the introduction there, been a bumpy kind of week or so for Rightmove, because this time last week its shares took a right whack as well because of, it seemed, investors' concerns about the amount it was going to spend on AI.
Investors never like surprises. We're rather boring. B, it's when you have a good thing going and suddenly you impact your own margins by cost addition, which hasn't been forced on you, is another sort of, okay, interesting. And then third is around, well, what is going to be the payback here? Mm. You know, you've already got this fantastic market share. You've clearly done very well from a relative platform standpoint. You account for 16 billion minutes spent online within the UK property market. What else is this really going to do for you?
Right. And so a concern as well that I suppose the thing that Rightmove does really well to be in that dominant position, that AI sort of eats away at that a bit as well. You know, you're sort of opening it up to other people rather than just being the place to search easily for properties.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of the AI bet to date has been around that spend and infrastructure, understanding data centres, data consumption. This is one of the sort of early ones in terms of, OK, it's replacing what you're already doing quite well digitally.
And we'll come to some more domestic economic matters in a moment, but just because that feels like it leads to another story overnight in the United States, big sell-off, and we've seen it this morning in Asia on stocks as well, particularly tech stocks. What's your sense of what's going on? Is that this similar AI concern again?
I think it's a few things at play. One is profit-taking. I think it's been a massive expansion. You've got to always take these sell-offs in the context of year-to-date.
Because the rally's been going for so long, particularly in tech stocks.
And it's not even, in some cases, it's been a multiplication of value. And so I wouldn't fault people for trying to take profit amid very uncertain times, as well as, you know, year-end dynamics in terms of portfolio management, some de-risking. I think you've had a government shutdown that is unprecedentedly long, the resolution of which has been, well, let's just kick this down into January rather than actually resolving the fundamental disconnect. So we can't rule out another one, and we're not quite sure where it's going to resolve itself. I think third is, within that AI sell-off, you know, there's some winners and losers. People who came late to the party or seem to have a very capex-intense strategy are getting punished, like an Oracle, versus others who've been at the forefront of success. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. I dread to call it, you know, this is the end of the AI cycle. Absolutely not. We're still learning the uses and applications of it. And so I wouldn't call that a giant sell-off thus far. But it is a confidence issue as well.
So more a kind of recalibration, yeah, you think, at this point as well. Well, let's turn then to that story that Nick was talking about. It's in the very well sourced in the FT, among others, this morning, isn't it? We've talked quite a bit in this slot about this proposal. Two up, two down, lots of people have called it, that sounded like was a runner and rider to be in the budget around income tax. This is where income tax would rise 2p and you would cut the corresponding cut in national insurance of 2p in the other direction. The theory being it brings lots of people in who don't pay national insurance, pensioners, landlords, that kind of people who make wealth in other ways from sort of salaried income. Ripped up is the term the FT have for that today. I just wonder what your take would be on what that may impact that may have on bond markets, lending markets today, when we've seen sort of another policy that looked like it was people getting used to it and then suddenly it's taken away again, potentially.
I think a lot of us in the investing space had sort of inured ourselves to that. Well, the only way from here is an increase in income tax. And so seeing this being ruled out is a bit of a surprise, to say the least. The second is around, well, what happens next? How are you going to fill that hole? Are you now going to renege on filling that hole in fiscal responsibility? That then feeds into lower confidence, which then feeds into higher bond yields as a consequence. That then feeds into the cost of borrowing, which means, right, you've got an even bigger hole. So that's going to shake people somewhat. And it's trying to think of, you know, we've had so many different ideas be surfaced or floated through leaks, whether they were intentional or not. And all seeming to be tinkering at the edges versus attacking the fundamental issue, which is, this rather large and increasing gap. And so now it's like, well, what's going to go from here? And I think we talked about a smorgasbord of options and, small adjustments here and there.
I mean, is that in itself an issue? If it is a smorgasbord, you know, lots of little things to try and make it add up. We've seen in the growth numbers this week that seems to be causing a lot of people to pause and wait and see, is it me? Is it our sector? Is it my area?
Absolutely. And it's the complexity of it as well. Digesting a varied bit of information and varied initiatives versus one singular thing. And I appreciate there are certain campaign promises. And so there's a sort of question around, OK, if you start reneging on those promises, what else might you renege on? And that then, undermines confidence in the government. But for, particularly small businesses to contend with, it is adding complexity and uncertainty. But overall, that's been the case. We have been in stasis, and that has slowed us down in terms of hiring. Job vacancies, as you know, remain flat. GDP has been treading water. All because of this.
Zaina, thanks so much for your time this morning. Zaina Bain, Managing Partner at Sullivan Street Partners there. Now, the Cycle to Work scheme, which allows employees to purchase a bike and accessories with an interest-free loan from their employer, seems to be also in line for a change at the budget, one of those smorgasbord of options, it seems. It's been reported that the Chancellor is planning to introduce a cap on the cost of bikes that can be bought through the scheme. Will Pearson is with us. Will's the co-owner of Pearson Cycles, known as the world's oldest bike shop. Will, morning.
Morning, Will.
Just explain a little bit then. How does it work when someone comes to you using this scheme, if they want to buy a bike from you through this scheme?
Well, typically customers would be armed with a voucher that they have applied for through their employer, and that voucher will give them a salary sacrifice on an amount to buy a bike, which will either save them 30% if you are a lower tax payer, or at a higher rate, you'll be saving anything around 42%.
And there's a threshold for that at the moment. It's £1,000, right? There was that threshold. It's moved, and they're talking about that coming back again for a bike. I mean, what impact would that have?
Well, I just think it's very short-sighted. The cap at £1,000 was changed in 2019, I think it was, just really showing that the cost of bikes has gone up. £1,000 wouldn't really get you anything particularly good in quality if you're a consistent and a regular user of a bicycle. They just won't last very long. And to actually buy something that is more reliable and efficient and is going to be more comfortable to ride, the bikes are just dearer than that, and you just need to spend more.
This quote that's in, again, the Financial Times this morning, Will, I don't know if you've seen it, supposedly from a government figure. Cycle to Work should be about helping ordinary commuters switch to greener travel, not giving tax breaks to high earners buying £4,000 e-bikes for weekend rides in the Surrey Hills.
I just don't think that's realistic. I mean, obviously, people do use their bikes beyond work, and I think that's a very good thing. The whole active transport and encouraging people to cycle is a huge benefit to their health, to the nation's health, those people that do it. and burdens on the NHS are reduced. So, you know, the fact that if people are going to use their bikes outside of the work environment, then it's only a boon.
Mm. And so it sounds like it could have an impact on your business. Will, thanks so much for your time this morning. Will Pearson, the co-owner of Pearson Cycles there.
Thanks, Will. 29 minutes past six. Carthy's here with the sport. Morning.
Morning, Anna. Thank you very much. We'll start with last night's World Cup qualifiers. England had already qualified for next summer's tournament. They beat Serbia 2-0 to maintain their 100% record in this campaign. The BBC's football correspondent John Murray reports from Wembley.
England made it 7 wins out of 7 in this campaign, still without conceding, as a well-taken goal in each half from the Arsenal pair of Bukayo Saka and Eberechi Eze equaled the team's record of 10 competitive wins in a row. After a tight opening period, England scored the first just before the half hour after a deflected shot from debutant Nico O'Reilly was dispatched by Saka's left foot. But the clinching second didn't come until the 90th minute as substitutes Foden and Eze combined for the Arsenal man to delightfully curl the ball in for 2-0. And the home goal survived a couple of scares for Jordan Pickford to make it 10 clean sheets in a row for him as the England goalkeeper.
There was an excellent win for the Republic of Ireland, a 2-0 victory over Portugal, who had Cristiano Ronaldo sent off with a straight red card. Ireland will secure at least a playoff place if they win in Hungary on Sunday. To cricket and the only warm-up match of the England Men's Ashes Tour. It's day two in Perth against the England Lions. The development side were all out for 375. In reply, England's men are 210 for four after 45 overs. Golf, and Rory McIlroy is two shots off the lead after the first round of the end-of-season DP World Tour Championship. McIlroy hit a 6-under par 66 as he aims to win a fourth consecutive Race to Dubai title.
Had a great weekend in Abu Dhabi, and today was just a continuation of that. Felt like I left a couple out there, if I'm honest. My wedge play and my approach play was probably as sharp as it's been all year, so that was great to see. And you know, if I can continue to do that over the next 3 days, you know, hopefully I'll give myself a great chance to win again around here.
And Carlos Alcaraz beat Italy's Lorenzo Musetti at tennis's ATP finals last night to secure the end of season world number one spot.
It's a great achievement after getting the win in this match and know that I achieved my goal of the year. It means a lot. I think I've been playing great tennis, so excited about keep it going, and I'm playing a semi-final here in the ATP Finals.
Alcaraz has edged out Jannik Sinner to that end of season world number one ranking. It's a pretty stark statistic. The world number three player, Alexander Zverev, is closer in points to the world number 1,000 than he is to those top two players in the world.
Wow, that is a huge gap.
It's bizarre. Anyway,
yeah, but it keeps the drama is still there because the competition between the two of them is so exciting to watch.
But they are far and away better than everybody else.
Yeah, don't give up though. Keep going. Thanks, Garthy. Hear from you again later. Now let's look ahead to some five-star comedy coming to Radio 4.
Enter the world of online reviews.
Unless you want to wake up screaming in the middle of the night, avoid.
Frank Skinner shares, one person found this helpful.
Who on earth is suspicious of a pen?
Oh, Joe, you sound very gullible right now.
With guests including Joe Caulfield, Ed Byrne and Pierre Novelli.
So I found a stress relief scream jar, but it's also known as an anger management shouting vase. One of the best reviews, 2 stars, get a pillow.
The new series of One Person Found This Helpful with me, Frank Skinner, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds next Tuesday night at 6:30.
It's 28 minutes to 7 now. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The BBC is waiting for a response from the White House after it apologised to President Trump for the way a Panorama episode edited a speech he gave on the day of the US Capitol riots in 2021. The BBC has rejected Mr. Trump's demand for compensation. The president and his lawyers have previously threatened a $1 billion lawsuit against the corporation. Resident doctors in England are beginning a 5-day strike over pay. Hospitals will come under the most strain, with resident doctors making up about half the medical workforce. NHS England said patients should still attend appointments unless advised otherwise. NHS bosses have warned that frontline staff or services may have to be cut because of the financial impact of the walkout. The Home Secretary will announce significant changes to the UK's asylum system on Monday. Shabana Mahmood is expected to tell MPs that successful asylum seekers will only be allowed to stay in the UK temporarily. If their home country is deemed safe, they'll be returned. It's part of the government's plan to model some of its immigration reforms on the Danish system, which is regarded as one of the toughest in Europe. The County Council's network is urging the government not to avoid reforms to the special educational needs system in England. Councils say it's facing total collapse and that rising demand for support will leave local authorities with a £4.4 billion annual deficit by 2029. The government has delayed planned changes until next year, insisting it wants to get them right. A rocket owned by the Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has successfully launched from Florida on its first flight for a paying customer. The Blue Origin rocket was carrying two NASA satellites bound for Mars, where they will collect information about its climate. After takeoff, the booster touched down safely in the Atlantic, allowing it to be used again.
Thank you, Caroline. 26 minutes to 7 now. We're sorry, but we're not paying. That's a short summary of the BBC's letter to President Trump in response to his lawyer's demands to pay him $1 billion for editing his speech on the day of the Capitol riots in a misleading way. Our entertainment correspondent, Lizo Mazimba, joins us now. Morning to you, Lizo.
Morning.
What's the argument in that letter as to why the BBC doesn't owe him any money?
Well, the BBC makes a number of assertions. It says it didn't have the rights to or distribute the Panorama episode in the United States. When it was available on iPlayer, it was restricted to the UK. It didn't cause Trump any harm, the BBC says, as he was re-elected shortly afterwards. It says the clip wasn't designed to mislead, just to shorten a long speech, so the edit wasn't done with malice. It was only 12 seconds in an hour-long programme that had lots of people speaking in support of President Trump, and that on a matter of public concern and political speech, that's heavily protected under defamation law in the United States. Now, what's interesting, I think, about the BBC's response, it's not unusual for lawyers behind the scenes privately to make all sorts of assertions, we're not paying you any money, as part of an ongoing negotiation that ends up somewhere very different. The BBC have made their position publicly, which means that if they were ever to move from that position, particularly on money, it would be exceptionally damaging for the corporation. So now we're just waiting to see what happens with Donald Trump's 10 p.m. Deadline for this evening, where he's threatening that $1 billion lawsuit. But even, of course, if he doesn't continue with that $1 billion lawsuit, there are still all sorts of ways in that he can try and bring pressure upon the BBC in the United States.
Well, not least by what he says. And we were told yesterday that he's giving an interview to GB News, also to The Telegraph as well, I think. And there will be more grist to his mill, given a second revelation about an editing of the same speech, not by Panorama this time, but by Newsnight.
Yes, of course, this emerged yesterday. The Telegraph reported that an edition of Newsnight from June 2022 made a similar, not identical, but similar edit to the Panorama edit, where Donald Trump talked at one point about going down to the Capitol and then something from 54 minutes later in the speech talked about we have to fight like hell. Putting them together in the way that many people are seeing is almost identical in the way it misrepresents what Donald Trump was saying in that. Now, the same mistake being made on Newsnight will add fire to the people who oppose the BBC and think there is some kind of groupthink going on, in that they think that the BBC has formed a particular opinion of Donald Trump and it then manipulates the facts to support that opinion. So for people that have that view of the BBC, incidents like this only go to support it. Of course, people within the BBC would say that's not the case. It was just a mistake that happened in a similar way.
We would love to put these questions to BBC management or the BBC board, but we continue to not get anyone who is prepared to talk to us. We will be talking to the Culture Secretary, though, at 10 past 8. Lizo Mazimba, thank you.
23 minutes to 7 now. Thousands of resident doctors across England will go on strike in the next half hour. It is in their dispute over pay. It's a five-day action. It is the 13th by doctors since March of 2023. Hugh Pym, our health editor, is with us. Morning, Hugh.
Good morning, Anna.
As we said there, this is a long-running dispute now. What is the current status of the position of both sides?
Well, yes, it's been running for a long time now, as you say, right back to the spring of 2023, a series of strikes. Then the general election came along and Wes Streeting became the health secretary, and he reached a deal over pay, and certainly the hope then from the government point of view was this would solve the problem with resident doctors, formerly known as junior doctors. But through till the middle of this year, pay was still the issue. The British Medical Association, the doctors' union, saying that had not been adequately resolved, that they wanted more money to compensate for the effect of inflation going back over two decades. And it came to a strike in July. Then there were 2 months of very intense negotiations and a new offer put by the government, but that was rejected by the BMA. Essentially, it boils down to this, that Wes Streeting says there isn't any more money for pay this year and he can't commit to pay in future years, but he has gone out of his way to find money to help doctors with things like paying exam fees and Royal College membership fees, creating more training places so there are more opportunities for newly qualified doctors. And he thinks that's a very reasonable offer, and he was essentially angry that it was turned down and this strike was called. Now, the BMA position is that they want a multi-year pay deal and that they just haven't had enough to compensate for inflation. That being said, the government says they've had nearly 29% over 3 years, and that is perfectly reasonable. And then this issue of jobs, that there are some newly qualified doctors struggling to find jobs and not enough training places. So the rhetoric has been dialed up quite a lot in recent days, and the strike goes ahead and no sign at the moment of any further talks.
And what about patients, Hugh? Because inevitably they will be thinking, what if I'm taken ill? What if a family member's taken ill? What does this mean for my treatment? Lots of questions. What should they be thinking today?
Well, trusts in England are saying that essentially almost all planned treatment will go ahead. Obviously, emergency cover is there. It's being covered by more experienced doctors, consultants and others. But elective surgery, the hospitals are really trying to get as much done as possible, but they still say there could be thousands postponed. Patients are being told, if you haven't heard so far, then do go along to your appointment. But employers in the shape of NHS providers and NHS Confederation are warning that the cost of the strike, the cost of providing cover for striking doctors and other financial pressures, up to £300 million over 5 days, plus the £300 million back in July. They're having to find all that from their own resources, and they are warning that basically if strikes continue, they will have to make cuts to staff and services. The BMA argument, though, is, well, the government could halt this strike if they were prepared to talk about pay, and they've rejected the employer's line as emotional blackmail.
Hugh, thank you. Hugh Pym there, our health editor, and we will hear from various sides in that dispute between now and nine.
It is now 19 minutes to seven. Income tax is not going up in the budget after all. That at least is what the Financial Times has learned. It would mark a dramatic last-minute change to a manifesto-busting plan to increase income tax by the Chancellor. And it's coming just 2 weeks before the budget. Harry Farley is our political correspondent. I can't remember a time like this, Harry, where effectively the government allows everyone to report that one thing's happening and then allows it to be reported that exactly the opposite is happening.
Absolutely. All the signals, not just from the Chancellor, but from the Prime Minister as well, is that they are gearing up for a breach of their manifesto, not just because they were unwilling to say that they remain committed to that manifesto, but also the Chancellor's language around all of us must play our part. That all fueled this speculation that we were looking at an increase to the rate of income tax. And Labour MPs I've been speaking to over the last week or so, they were very nervous about that prospect of breaching the manifesto. Many weren't actually opposed to the idea of increasing the rate of income tax, but they worried about the impact this would have on trust, on whether Labour's promises would be believed in the future. It's worth just looking at what Labour's manifesto said specifically. They said they wouldn't raise taxes on working people and specifically cited not raising the rates of income tax. That, of course, doesn't specify about the thresholds of income tax. And if that does happen, you know, either by freezing the threshold, so as people's incomes rise with inflation, more people are dragged into paying those higher rates of income tax. That's one option. Or, of course, the Chancellor could change the thresholds altogether. We're very much in the realms of speculation, but that could lead to an argument about semantics and whether changing or freezing the thresholds does break that manifesto. A couple of thoughts, though. Whether or not ministers argue that any changes or freezing to thresholds breaks the manifesto, it could be seen as doing so you lose that political trust without gaining the large sums that would that you would by raising the rates. And the other thought is that it could leave the Chancellor having to raise the taxes that she needs to raise by a whole host of other measures, and that can often prove politically dangerous.
Harry Farley, our political correspondent, thank you.
Well, in a surprise move yesterday in Parliament, the government announced it was getting rid of police and crime commissioners in England and Wales. And for well over an hour, MPs questioned the policing minister. Many praised their PCCs, and many also appealed for a slice of the money that's expected to be saved by it. Mandy Baker reports.
If you're not familiar with what a police and crime commissioner does, you're not alone. 2 in 5 people don't even know they exist. And that, in a nutshell, is the problem, according to the Home Office Minister, Sarah Jones.
Public understanding of and engagement with our police and crime commissioners remains low, despite efforts to raise their profile.
Police and crime commissioners were introduced in 2012 under the coalition government, meaning the 43 police forces in England and Wales had an elected official to answer to. Sarah Jones stressed that it wasn't the fault of the PCCs themselves, and she thanked them for their service.
But the reality is that the PCC model has weakened local police accountability and has had perverse impacts on the recruitment of chief constables. They have failed to inspire confidence in local people, in stark contrast to the mayoral model, which has clearly been ultimately more successful.
So, in 2028, the powers of the PCCs will be transferred to elected mayors, or for places that don't yet have one of those, council leaders sitting on new police and crime boards. There are no plans to have elected mayors in Wales, so Sarah Jones said she'd work with the Welsh Government on arrangements to replace PCCs there. The Conservative Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philp wasn't taken with the idea at all, certainly not the bit about council leaders sitting on boards.
This won't really save any money, but what it will do is remove a directly elected public official, the Police and Crime Commissioner, who is accountable to the public and would certainly be more visible than some kind of faceless committee of local bureaucrats.
More generally, he was withering.
This government, essentially, in their announcement today, is tinkering around the edges. They are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, while crimes like shoplifting rocket, while police numbers fall, and while the police face a funding crisis made in the Home Office.
Sarah Jones said from that she wasn't quite clear whether the Conservatives supported the abolition or not. Chris Philp frowned in a baffled sort of way. For the Lib Dems, Ben Maguire was glad the government had seen the wisdom of getting rid of police commissioners. The Lib Dems had been calling for it for years. As he explained why, MPs from other parties began muttering.
This was a failed Tory experiment which cost taxpayers dearly. The minister is right to point out the countless flaws in the overly politicised PCC model, which has diverted much-needed funding away from frontline and community policing.
To the delight of much of the House, the minister put into words what the heckles have been all about.
Can I thank the opposition spokesperson for his robust attack on a policy that his own party introduced as part of the coalition in 2010?
There are a number of questions about how the announcement would affect people day to day. Sarah Jones said the abolition of PCCs would bring savings.
We estimate that at least £100 million will be saved this Parliament by moving to these new arrangements. Once delivered, the changes are expected to achieve savings to the Home Office of around £20 million a year, enough to fund around 320 extra police constables.
Several MPs alighted on that and took the opportunity to put in a bid for some of the cash. The Conservative Ben Obsey-Jecty represents Huntingdon, the scene of the mass stabbings on a train a fortnight ago. He said it could have been far worse without the swift action of Cambridgeshire Constabulary.
Neutralising the threat and placing the suspect in custody within 8 minutes of the 999 call being placed. But the government is lucky that this was the outcome. Cambridgeshire is the fourth worst funded police force in England and Wales and also doesn't receive the South East allowance.
While other MPs wanted extra investment for their constituencies to tackle burglary, shoplifting and antisocial behaviour, a Lib Dem, Rachel Gilmore, described a different kind of crime wave.
People in my constituency have literally had bullocks, sheep, and in one particular instance, an entire flock of 1,500 chickens rustled from their farms.
And she appealed for extra resources to tackle rural crime. Many MPs were keen to pay tribute to their local crime commissioner, but Reform UK's Sarah Poachin, not so much.
The PCC in Cheshire has proved to be one of the starkest examples of failure, achieving no meaningful improvement in crime or policing, devoting his time to political campaigning.
If you're one of the 2/5 of the population who didn't know police and crime commissioners existed, you've only got till 2028 to read up.
That is Mandy Baker reporting. It's 12 minutes to 7. We talk, don't we, so often about impending drought when it's pouring down with rain, and Storm Claudia's bringing plenty of that this morning, through the day, through tomorrow as well. But the Environment Agency is warning that without a properly wet winter, England will experience widespread drought next year. Helen Wakeham is Director of Water at the Environment Agency. Good morning.
Good morning.
I mention the weather because it's true, isn't it? So often people think, well, we're a wet country, we get plenty of rain. But as we've seen this summer, the cycle just isn't really working for us, and we are seeing drought already.
That's right. We've had, despite the everybody waking up to a wet morning, much of the England is already in drought. And we've had a very, very hot summer and a very, very dry spring. So today the Environment Agency is publishing a droughts prospect report, and that's working with water companies, farmers, environmental organisations, the Canal and Rivers Trust and other partners to look at the current water situation in England, and knowing that droughts can last a long time, what could happen next year? And that helps us to prepare for what comes next. The Met Office is predicting that the winter will be drier than normal, and that's not great. So we need to prepare for dry weather and drought next year.
Tell me more about what we can do, because you think, well, we don't have any control really over what falls from the sky and how much. So what is within our control?
Well, for individuals, there's quite a lot that people can do. Very, very simple things. Look at the leaky taps and loos around the home do leak a lot of water. Thinking about water saving devices around the home, so different sorts of shower heads, all that makes a real difference. As a country, we're planning for drier conditions ahead, so we're planning for 10 new reservoirs, water transfer schemes, lots of things to make our water more resilient. At least half of what we will need to do will be around our management of demand. And that's in the home, that's water companies fixing leaks, that's the government's doing a great thing to put water efficiency labelling on appliances, for example. Farmers can work together to share water, and we're working with them around local water, local small reservoirs for farmers. So there's all sorts of things as a country we can do, and all sectors can start to think about their water use and plan for water supply in the future.
Are all of those sectors doing enough? Because you mentioned there, for example, water companies fixing leaks, and we know that that doesn't happen quickly enough, and they say that they don't have the money to fix that ageing infrastructure. So what happens there?
So there's a huge investment in the water industry in the next 5 years. So £108 billion worth of investment in our water infrastructure. That's a brilliant thing for the country. What we've seen this year in our dry 2025 is a coalition of water companies, farmers, environmental groups, all working brilliantly together to tackle the prolonged dry weather we've had this summer. What we need is for everybody to keep the pressure on and to keep doing that through the winter, even when we get the occasional rainy day.
Helen Wakeham, Director of Water at the Environment Agency, thank you. And speaking about occasional rainy days, Sam will be here with the weather in a few minutes.
Look forward to that, or maybe not. It's 8 minutes to seven now. The timetable for the long-promised ban on landlords evicting tenants without reason has been set out by ministers. The ban on so-called Section 21 evictions comes into force in 6 months' time. What will that mean for renters and indeed for landlords? Let's discuss that with Tom Darling, director at the Renters Reform Coalition, and with Neil France, who is a landlord who lets out 7 properties across the UK. Morning to you both.
Morning, Nick.
Morning.
Tom, let's deal with the timetable because that's the newest thing. Are you pleased that it's coming in, or did you want it even faster than that?
We would have liked to have seen it faster than that. Long-time listeners of the programme might remember that this was first promised in 2019 by then Prime Minister Theresa May. But I think the important thing is we have a date, 1st of May 2026, that Every contract, rental contract in the country will change to be a rolling contract. Landlords won't be able to evict tenants through Section 21 no-fault evictions. Instead, they'll have to appeal to a court. Renters will have new rights and they'll be able to challenge above-market rent increases. And landlords won't be able to unreasonably refuse requests for pets. Also, if you're shopping around trying to get a new tenancy, landlords won't be able to request more than 1 month's rent in advance. There'll be a ban on bidding wars that sometimes estate agents pit renters against each other, and there'll also be a ban on discriminating against prospective tenants. Later in 2026, there'll be other parts of the Act come into force, like the database and the Ombudsman, and then even later than that, we're hearing that the parts of the Act around increasing standards, including introducing a new decent home standard, will come into force.
Let's focus on what's happening imminently, well, at least in 6 months' time. But I suspect, Neil France, for a landlord, it feels like you have imminent decisions about whether you still want to carry on being a landlord under those new, tougher conditions.
You're absolutely right, Nick. I think we are a race of people who are being targeted. And I think the issue for me as a landlord is it's brought everything into focus as to do you continue or not. And I'm sure I'm not the only landlord that feels that.
Would you spell out, if you would, for us, Neil, what is it that you will not be able to do in future that you can do now that makes you worry about whether it is worthwhile carrying on as a landlord?
Well, I think the major issue is that, and I know Ben Beadle has been from the National Residential Landlords Association has been lobbying on this on our behalf, is that if you do have a tenant that is causing issues, the process, my understanding is of this Renters' Rights Bill, is that we're going to be able to sign up to an ombudsman. Everybody listens to the ombudsman in terms of the tenant and the landlord. We don't have to go through the courts. And what happens is the process of removing a tenant who may be causing issues with other tenants or other neighbours, etc., can be done quite smoothly. But that side of the process, I don't know what's going on. I haven't heard anything as to whether the government's actually set anything up on that.
Let me put that to Tom Darling of the Renters Reform Coalition. You can hear the worry there that it may be difficult to remove tenants who not just the landlords would want to remove, but perhaps other renters as well.
Yeah, I mean, the new system establishes that landlords will have to prove an eviction ground in a court. Since the 80s, since the Thatcher deregulation of private renting, England has been one of the most landlord-friendly places of any high-income country. So we've been sort of living with that experiment of the deregulation of private renting for the last 35 years.
But you think he will still be able to evict someone if he needs to?
If he needs to, okay. Yes, in extremis. And the government have been very clear that there will still be ways to evict tenants. But
Sorry, forgive me, because time is a little bit short. Neil, you say you're thinking of getting out of the market. Do you know other landlords who are saying, look, enough, we're not sticking with this?
I think absolutely. I think a lot of landlords are selling to the big corporates now. We've only got to look at Lloyds Bank buying something like 7,000 private rented homes. So you know what's going to happen there.
The small spell it out, Neil, if you would. When you say what's going to happen, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think rents are going to go up and okay. I think landlords are going to disappear.
We've literally got 10 seconds left. Tom, your reaction to that?
When a landlord sells their home, it doesn't sink into the ground. There's no explosives put underneath it. Our housing is a system, and if the private rented sector got slightly smaller, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
Neil France, Tom Darling, thank you very much indeed. We will keep watching this, and of course, we won't know until those new rights are implemented in 6 months' time, but we'll keep a close eye on it then.
What has the weather got in store for us today? It's not going to be pleasant. Simon King's here, morning.
No, Anna, it is not. We've got some pretty heavy rain at the moment across England and Wales. This is because of Storm Claudia, which brings us rain continuing all day today, really. So I'll talk broadly across England and Wales. We've got amber warnings for parts of South East Wales, East Wales, the Midlands and towards Eastern England. We could see up to a whole month's worth of rain falling in the space of 24 hours, and that is likely to bring some flooding, some transport disruption through the course of today. Elsewhere, there's a larger yellow warning in force across many parts, but in the southeast of England, it's here where actually there may be some dry and brighter weather with a bit of sunshine later on this afternoon, especially for parts of Kent and East Sussex. A strong gusty wind to go with all this rain as well. Very unpleasant day, really. Maximum temperatures are relevant at 12 to 16 degrees. Now, for Northern Ireland, it's pretty cloudy this morning with some outbreaks of rain, but it's going to turn sunnier into this afternoon. Maximum temperatures of 7 to 9 degrees. And for Scotland, it's a chilly start. We've got a frost in northern Scotland. Clear skies here, so lots of sunshine expected through today. In southern Scotland, quite cloudy with some outbreaks of rain. That rain will tend to clear away. Maximum temperatures of 4 to 6 degrees. But through tonight, that rain across much of England and Wales continues into Saturday morning. Clearer skies for Scotland, so a frost again. The rain only gradually easing during Saturday, but it will do eventually, just persisting a little bit across northern parts of England. Some sunshine again for Scotland, chilly here, but elsewhere temperatures 10 to 15 Celsius.
Today is the birthday of His Majesty the King.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday the 14th of November. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford. The headlines this morning: resident doctors are just beginning a five-day strike in England, defying warnings from hospital bosses that it could lead to jobs and services being cut. NHS England will join us just after the news. Donald Trump has yet to respond to the BBC's apology to him, but its refusal to pay compensation for a misleading edit of one of his speeches. We'll be asking where this standoff goes next and where does it leave accusations of institutional bias against the corporation. We'll hear what the Conservatives have to say in half an hour and from the Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy, who joins us at 8:10. And the Home Secretary is expected to say that successful asylum seekers will only be allowed to stay in the UK temporarily.
Also in today's programme, killed by those who should have loved her, let down by every service. What can we learn from the inquiry into the death of 10-year-old Sara Sharif? The Children's Commissioner will join us. Could the Chancellor not be raising income tax after all? And it's a Saturday night institution across the pond. Yep, Saturday Night Live is coming to the UK next year with its creative team just announced. Will the formula translate? All that after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Resident doctors in England are beginning a five-day walkout this morning, their second strike this year in a dispute over pay. NHS bosses have said frontline staff or services may have to be cut because of the financial impact. The Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, has dismissed the warning as emotional blackmail. Our health editor Hugh Pym has the details.
Hospitals hope to carry out most of the planned treatment, but the NHS Confederation and NHS providers warn that thousands of patients could still have appointments and procedures cancelled. Trusts will redeploy senior doctors to prioritise emergency services. Employers say that the cost of the action, up to £300 million, and similar to the previous strike, is not covered by the government, so will pile more pressure on constrained budgets and could lead to service cuts. The BMA said that the government could stop the strike with a new offer on jobs and on pay, compensating for past inflation. But ministers say doctors have had a nearly 29% increase over 3 years, and that an offer of help on medical costs and a commitment to more jobs for newly qualified doctors was turned down.
There's been no response so far from President Trump after the BBC apologised to him for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches, but rejected his demand for compensation. In a statement last night, the BBC said the edit in a Panorama documentary had given the impression that he'd called for violence after losing the presidency to Joe Biden 5 years ago.
It's written to Mr. Trump and his lawyers, who've threatened a $1 billion lawsuit. Here's our media editor, Katie Razzle.
Two letters, an apology, and a promise not to broadcast the panorama again. But the BBC has told the president it will not be paying him compensation for editing together sections of a speech he made on the day of the Capitol Hill riots in January 2021. While the BBC sincerely regrets the manner in which the video clip was edited, said a spokesperson, we strongly disagree there is a basis for a defamation claim. The corporation pointed out to the president's legal team that it did not broadcast the programme on any US channels. It also said Donald Trump didn't suffer any harm as a result of the panorama. He was elected president soon after it was broadcast. The ball is now in the president's court. The BBC is also examining a report that in 2022, 2 years before Panorama, an edition of Newsnight ran a similarly edited version of the speech, albeit with more context. This new revelation prompted an accusation from the president's legal team of a pattern of defamation by the BBC. The corporation said it rejected this.
The Conservatives have called for a review of processes and procedures at the BBC, saying licence fee payers should not have to pay the price for poor editorial decisions. The Liberal Democrats have called on the Prime Minister to get on the phone to President Trump to stop him suing the corporation. The Department for Culture, Media and Sport has not commented. Emergency services in Ukraine say a Russian missile and drone attack on the capital Kyiv overnight has killed one person and wounded 15 others. Officials said a hospital and a school were targeted in the strikes. Our correspondent, James Landale, reports from Kyiv.
This was the most severe attack on Kyiv for several weeks. Explosions could be seen and heard across the night sky as Russian missiles and drones competed with the capital's air defences. The emergency services said many people had been wounded and there were reports of several deaths. Pictures posted on social media showed direct hits on several high-rise apartment blocks. There was also damage caused by falling debris, with reports of fires in buildings across much of the city. Kyiv's mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, described it as a massive enemy attack and warned supplies of power and water could be restricted. Public transport was also disrupted.
Council leaders are urging the government not to duck reforms to the special educational needs system in England, which they say is facing total collapse. The County Councils Network says rising demand will leave local authorities with a £4.4 billion annual deficit by the end of this parliament. The government has delayed planned changes until next year, saying it wants to get them right. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth reports.
It's widely accepted that the special educational needs and disability system is buckling, with rising demand, parents often having to battle for support and budgets under huge strain. Council leaders in England are calling for billions in funding deficits to be written off, investment in specialist provision in mainstream schools, and changes to education, health and care plans, the legal documents that underpin a child's right to support. But many campaigners have warned against watering down legal protections for families. Some Labour MPs have warned ministers not to focus on cutting spending, pointing to the backlash over the government's attempt at welfare reform. The Department for Education said the government had already made progress with funding for more specialist school places and early intervention, and was listening to families and would continue engaging with parents.
The ban on landlords evicting tenants in England without providing a reason will come into force in 6 months' time. It's one of the changes brought in by the Renters' Rights Act, which became law last month. Our housing reporter Tara Welsh has more details.
Renters' groups have for years been calling for a ban on Section 21 notices or no-fault evictions. They allow landlords to evict a tenant with just 8 weeks' notice without giving a reason. From the 1st of May, there'll be a number of sweeping changes. Rental bidding wars will be made illegal. Landlords will only be able to increase rents once a year, and tenants will have the right to request a pet. But one of the biggest changes will be that tenancies will no longer have fixed terms. They'll be ongoing. The government says the changes will provide more security for renters, and landlords will still be able to evict tenants under certain circumstances. Landlord groups, though, say they're concerned that the court system will be too slow if things go wrong.
MPs say the Ministry of Defence has still not done enough to prevent a repeat of the massive data leak involving Afghans seeking resettlement in the UK. The Public Accounts Committee says a new scheme set up to relocate them will cost at least £850 million. The MOD estimates more than 27,000 Afghans affected by the breach could be brought to the UK. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
MPs say there have been dozens of data breaches in the MOD unit handling the requests of Afghans who want to flee the Taliban and resettle in the UK. The Public Accounts Committee calls it a farrago of errors and missteps. The leak that happened in February 2022, with more than 18,000 Afghans named, was the most serious so far. MPs say it put thousands of lives in danger. Nor are they confident it won't happen again. The MOD says the breach under the last government should never have happened and that it's making improvements to the way it handles sensitive data.
The Home Secretary is expected to outline significant reforms to illegal migration and the UK asylum system on Monday. Shabana Mahmood is modelling her reforms on Denmark's system, where a centre-left government has introduced one of the toughest asylum systems in Europe. Last night, the Home Office published figures claiming nearly 50,000 illegal migrants have been removed or deported from the UK since Labour entered power. The billionaire Jeff Bezos' space company, Blue Origin, has successfully launched a rocket on its first flight for a paying customer. The giant New Glenn rocket was carrying two NASA satellites bound for Mars. The launch from Florida represents a major step forward for Blue Origin as the booster rocket touched down safely in the Atlantic, allowing it to be used again.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven. The 13th walkout by resident doctors in England, formerly known as junior doctors, has just begun in the last few minutes. The long-running pay dispute saw its first strike back in March of 2023. Doctors say that their pay is, in real terms, a fifth lower than it was in 2008, once inflation's taken into account. But the government and hospital leaders point to the fact that for the second consecutive year, resident doctors have had the highest pay increases across the public sector this year. It was 5.4%. Well, Professor Meghana Pandit, who's Medical Director at NHS England, joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm interested to know more, and I know that patients will be interested to know more about the impact that this is having. So on a day like today, and in fact for the next 5 days when resident doctors, many of them are not working, what does that do to patient care?
Thank you. I think it's really important to say that all the other staff who work in the NHS are present, are working, and they will work to their level best to maintain safe services in the NHS. You would have heard Sir Jim Mackey say that we will try our best to maintain at least 95% of planned activity. The impact of these strikes is huge on patients and on staff. Patients' procedures and clinics and operations, which are planned for days and weeks and months, you know, can be rescheduled or cancelled, and we don't want that happening. That's a big deal for everyone. And these delays can cause harm, so we don't want that happening. It also has an impact on regular activities within hospitals, if you can imagine, that other staff having to cover those who are absent from work or striking. So we will together make sure that patients get the care that they need. We will maintain safe services and aim at least to continue with 95% activity. That said, if anyone has a life-threatening emergency, please call 999. And for all other purposes, if they need medical attention, please either see your GP online or walk in or dial 111 or see a pharmacist. Everyone else will be working.
You talked about safe care and safe services, and that is clearly a priority. The BMA has said that they will not agree to what's called derogations. This is where resident doctors are asked to leave the strike and work when patient safety is at risk. They say they won't do that unless NHS trusts have already cancelled planned activity and incentivised other medics to provide cover. Does that present or create a situation where some cases might fall through the cracks?
So first thing to say is I myself meet with the BMA at least twice a day during the strike period, and we've agreed that the principle for these discussions is patient safety. Make sure that locally, the chief medical officers and chief nurses in various provider organizations, trusts, hospitals, they know what safe care is for their organization. And we have taken assurances from them that they have and will manage safety in their organization. If they reach a situation where they feel a mitigation is required, then they will complete what we call a patient safety mitigation form, which is then assessed regionally and nationally in the NHS, which is when we then discuss it with the BMA officials. In July this year, when the earlier strikes happened, we did actually talk about at least a handful of patient safety mitigations, and the derogations were granted. So it really depends on the situation. That said, we have been focusing on these 5 days and maintenance of safety. And I know that locally, at trust level, chief medical officers and chief nurses and everyone else is focused on and has provided assurance of safe care.
Professor Meghana Pandit, Medical Director at NHS England, thank you for joining us.
It is 13 minutes past seven now. What can we, what should we learn from the death of 10-year-old Sara Sharif, who was killed by those who should have loved her, let down by every service? Those were the words of England's Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel D'Souza, who joins us in the Today programme studio. Good morning to you. You said the death was due to a catalogue of missed opportunities, poor communications and ill-informed assumptions.
Look, Sara's death was caused by those who should have loved her the most, her parents. But I was shocked when I heard the court case, and even more shocked and horrified when I read the review that's just come out. At every single stage, she was let down. And what I would say is, from reading it, Sara's death was preventable. It was preventable. The information about her father, everything that it was available, but it was just not available in one place. And that is not good enough.
Ah, well, let's try and break down then why it happened. The in one place, are you saying that was crucial? That was not a combination of intelligence?
Yeah, so look, I sat here with you, Nick, 4 years ago when I started this job, talking about the death of Arthur Lobinho Hughes. And I said to you, if we don't change this, we're going to have these deaths again. And one of the key recommendations then that I've been making since then is proper data sharing and information sharing. The social worker wrote an inadequate report. The judge accepted an inadequate report. The police had information on the father. We live in a world, our children live in a world, where they pick up a mobile phone and compress it and get information in one place. Social services should have that, should be equipped with that.
And is it the absence of that technology? Yes. Yeah. But that then, you know what they'll say is, we haven't got the money, Rachel, they'll say to you.
The death of a child is not, I mean, if we don't invest in this and do it quickly, you see, if you look at the Labour manifesto, they said they're going to have a unique identifier. Here we are a year and a half on. I've yet to see it. We need a unique identifier. We need proper data sharing. In some areas of the country, social care is doing this. For example, you know, Leeds data share. Lots of people have set their own up. Do you know, my little office of 30 people are going to build one and give it to the government and say, do this, because it is so crucial. Her death was preventable, apart from the fact that they did not listen to her voice or her mother's voice. You know, they also did not share the data.
There is another problem that was highlighted, which is race and fear of being labelled racist. The neighbours said that they were nervous to raise anything because they thought they'd be called racist. The school said that they thought there was a link with Sara's interest in Pakistani culture was one of the reasons that she was staying off school. How, if that's the case, do you deal with that?
Look, the lack of curiosity there is stunning and shocking to me. And I don't buy that as an excuse for 1 minute. We've worked in a multicultural Britain. I've been a head teacher in lots in areas. We absolutely, if a child presents with bruises, you ask why they're wearing the hijab. There is no sensitivity there. And I just say on the point about the neighbours, like, anybody listening, if you are worried about a child's safety, if you are hearing cries and screams, do not let any sensitivity get in the way. Report it to the police or social services. Just do it.
And money overall. I need to ask you, because again, is there a sense in which the authorities almost don't want to find a case? Because as soon as they do, it's on their budget.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've called for standardised thresholds when it comes to these cases for just that reason. I've seen
just
really...
Just spell out what a standardised threshold would be.
Well, basically, so that there isn't a choice about budget. It's like, if there are these concerns, you deal with it. You deal with it straight away. Let's face it, the job of the state is to keep its citizens safe. If we were talking about terrorism, if we were talking about immigration on the borders, no amount of money would be a concern. Keeping these vulnerable children safe is the job of the state. That's why I'm going to be writing to the Prime Minister today to ask him how he's going to make sure he keeps children safe.
Dame Rachel D'Souza, thank you for joining us. The England's Children's Commissioner there.
18 minutes past seven. There's plenty of speculation about changes in the budget to the way that property taxes work. Will Bain is back with the boss of one of the UK's largest real estate companies, Will.
Morning, Anna. Yeah, that's right. This is Landsec, the property developer with a portfolio that spans retail sites like Liverpool One and Bluewater in Kent, plus offices and now residential locations as well. And Mark Allen is the chief executive of Landsec and joins us this morning. Mark, morning.
Good morning.
Seemed a big fall in pre-tax profit. Just what drove that?
Well, there's two bits to our pre-tax profit. The important bit is the cash profit. That's the rent we get in less the costs of running the business. That was up 3.2%, and that's what pays the dividends. We've upgraded that for the full year as well, and we've upgraded our guidance on that for the 5 years to 2030. So that's the important bit. That's up. The other element relates to non-cash sort of valuation movements. That's really a reflection of still a fairly quiet investment market in the property world. Yeah. That's really a function of where interest rates are in the gilt market.
I was just going to ask you exactly that. Where's that sort of quietness coming from? Where's that unease from people who would normally be your customers coming from, do you think?
So this is about investors buying real estate, and the way they look at the value of real estate is linked directly to the value of government bonds. And government bond values have been depressed. Yields have been a little bit higher. That's really a function, of course, of the UK's standing in bond markets. And so that for us is the big thing that we need to see to get investment markets moving on, is confidence from bond markets. And it feeds into all other capital markets and is a critical element of driving economic growth and investment.
You saw kind of a tick up in occupancy rates again. Was that across the board, or is there one area that's kind of outperforming? I'm wondering around kind of offices in particular, perhaps, obviously.
It's across the board. I mean, offices are just under 99% occupied. The retail portfolio is about 97% occupied. The theme, and it's a theme that just gets stronger and stronger, whichever sector you look at, is you have to own the right real estate. If you're in the right location, providing the right quality and type of real estate, the demand is strong and is growing. So occupancy up and rents are growing.
And you point to both.
If you're not there...
Sorry, Mark, I was going to say you point to both that and this kind of worrying kind of, I guess you could talk about the what, notwithstanding the wider economic environment, what are you most concerned about? Is that to do with the budget?
That's really, again, about interest rates. From an investment point of view, I mean, we've historically been investing in new development activity, roughly about £1 billion a year. By the middle of next year, that'll be down at £200 million. Development doesn't really work for us at the moment. And the reason for that is largely because interest rates are as high as they are. So for us to be able to have the confidence to invest in new development activity, which has historically been quite a big part of the business, that needs us to be confident that rates are going to be lower for longer.
Mark Allen, the Chief Executive of Landsec, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. It's 21 minutes past seven. Earlier this week, speaking to Matt Chorley on Five Live, the Chancellor gave her strongest hint yet that she might break Labour's manifesto commitment not to increase income tax rates.
It would, of course, be possible to stick with the manifesto commitments, but that would require things like deep cuts in capital spending.
There has been widespread speculation that she would cut employee national insurance, increase income tax. But this morning, the Financial Times is reporting that the Chancellor and the Prime Minister will scrap that plan. It's worth saying that the BBC has asked the Treasury to comment on that report. No response as yet. But it is an interesting suggestion if minds have been changed. Let's speak to Paul Johnson, the economist, former director of the IFS, now Provost of the Queen's College, Oxford, senior advisor at Frontier Economics. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
Putting to one side the political decisions, which are clearly a driver of this, and just looking purely from a financial point of view, if that has been dismissed as an idea, then where else can Rachel Reeves go to raise the money that she needs to?
Well, it's difficult to raise the very large sums that it looks like she's going to need without doing things to income tax. So if she's not going to raise rates, it seems that she may well decide to cut the point at which you start to pay income tax or start to pay higher rate income tax. That's certainly what's speculated about in the Financial Times this morning. Now, everyone expected in any case that she would freeze for another couple of years the point at which you start to pay that lower, the basic and higher rates of tax. That gets you another 10 billion or so. So that's quite a big tax rise in itself. And it's quite nice politically because you don't actually see any fall in take home pay. But you could raise really significant extra sums by actually cutting in cash terms the point at which you start to do that. Now, the oddity in the sense of doing that is a less progressive or more regressive way of increasing taxes than increasing the rates of the tax. It hits lower income people a little bit more and will certainly drag a lot more people into tax at all and into higher rate tax.
And how do you sell that to people who will be listening to every twist and turn of this and thinking, what does that mean for me?
Well, it's more difficult than simply freezing the allowances, because if you freeze them, then you don't actually see that cash change, even if year by year more of your money is dragged into tax or into higher rate tax. We're already seeing a remarkable change to the system. So just before the pandemic, about 1 in 10 people were paying higher rate tax. About 1 in 10 employees were paying higher rate tax. That's already going up to about 1 in 4. So that's a remarkable change already. If you cut the point at which you start to pay, as they have in Scotland. So in Scotland, you start to pay around 44,000, in England, in about 50,000. If you cut that, then obviously you start to see those, you know, really quite significant changes in your take-home pay. So in that sense, it has the same negative political effect as cutting the rate. If you actually see a fall in your take-home pay, if you cut the cash point, which you start to pay tax.
And you touched on it right at the start, Paul, but when Rachel Reeves looks at the suite of options in front of her, there are so many of them that are actually, they sound big, but the money, the amount of money they raise is relatively piecemeal. There aren't many things that she can do that raise a lot of money in one stroke.
Well, that's right. I mean, if, as everyone is speculating, she needs, say, 30 or even 40 billion a year, there's lots of things she can do. People have talked about gambling taxes and capital gains taxes and bank taxes and all sorts of things, and putting a lot of those together might be economically damaging in any case, but none of them raises really big amounts of money. If you want really big amounts of money, you need to look at the really big taxes, and those are the ones that were broadly ruled out in the manifesto. The really big ones are income tax, national insurance, and VAT. Corporation tax is also pretty big nowadays, but actually that was also ruled out in the manifesto. So that's why economically, and to get that kind of money, you need to do what she did last year. Remember, last year she increased the rate of national insurance contributions. Now it was the rate on employers, but it was the rate of NI. And the reason she did that, she needed a lot of money. And it's really, really hard to find a lot of money unless you do something with one of those big three taxes.
Yeah. Paul Johnson, thank you for joining us. As I said, we're continuing to dig into this, the BBC looking for a response. I suppose it would be understandable if you're quite looking forward to the budget actually being here and being done to end the speculation that's been going on for weeks and months now about what Rachel Reeves might actually do when it happens.
Yeah, we'll learn in a couple of weeks' time. 26 minutes past seven, here's Cathy with a sport.
Thank you very much. England had already qualified for next summer's Men's Football World Cup, but they beat Serbia 2-0 in last night's World Cup qualifier at Wembley to make it 7 wins out of 7 so far in this campaign. The Republic of Ireland had a 2-0 victory over Portugal, who had Cristiano Ronaldo sent off with a straight red card. Ireland will secure at least a playoff place if they win in Hungary on Sunday. Golf now, and Rory McIlroy is 2 shots off the lead after the first round of the end-of-season DP ATP World Tour Championship. We can speak to the BBC's golf correspondent, Ian Carter, who's in Dubai. Ian, McIlroy is the defending champion there. He's sounding very confident. Is he looking it at the moment?
He most certainly is. He finished last week in Abu Dhabi with a round of 62, his lowest ever score on the DP World Tour, finished third there, and he's picked up where he left off. An excellent 66 yesterday, just one bogey in that round, two shots off the lead that is held by Michael Kim. He'll be teeing off in the next hour and looking very, very confident, I think very much at ease now as the Masters winner, the man who completed the career Grand Slam back in April and then, of course, played such a starring role in the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, it was interesting, those two particularly big events that you've just mentioned. Does he seem to be playing a bit more freely now? You mentioned the ease, but is there just a general sense about him that things have changed this year?
I do get that impression. I think in the immediate aftermath of his victory at Augusta at the Masters, there was something of a hangover. He was pretty muted at the next couple of majors. He was much more his old self when he played in his native Northern Ireland at Royal Portrush with a top 10 at the Open Championship. And as this season has gone on, he just seems to be ever more comfortable with his newfound status in the game. And I think the other thing to say is that he is proving a very vocal supporter of the DP World Tour as well. As we head to the end of the DP World Tour season, he's now on the threshold of winning the Race to Dubai, the season-long money list, for the seventh time.
Yeah, it's interesting that point about him being vocal, because in the past he has mentioned that sometimes that has taken over a little bit from his golf, but he has suggested to Europe's biggest stars that they do need to step up and support the tour, as you mentioned. How much do you think he is taking on that sort of elderly statesman role again?
He's very happy to, as he says, opine from the sidelines. If you think back a couple of years, he was on the board of the PGA Tour right at the time that the breakaway LIV Tour came along, and he's admitted that that was a big distraction to him. And as soon as he resigned from the board and rededicated himself to that task of completing the career Grand Slam, winning the Masters, making sure that the accomplishments on the course of the priority rather than off the course, I think he's been a different man, but he still has very strong opinions and he's prepared to give them, as he did to me at the start of this week when he said that the big stars of European golf should continue to support the DP World Tour.
Yep, interesting interview with you, Ian, on the BBC Sport website. I say elderly statesman, he's still only 36 years old, isn't he? Thank you very much, Ian Carter in Dubai. A quick couple of other headlines for you. Cricket and the only warm-up match of the England Men's
Thank
Ashes
you.
Tour.
I think I'm needed on five lines now.
Oh, I'm sure you are. It's day two in Perth against the England Lions. The development side were all out for 375. In reply, England men are 263 for four after 55 overs. And in tennis, Carlos Alcaraz beat Italy's Lorenzo Musetti at the ATP finals last night, and he has secured the end of season world number one spot.
Thank you, Carthy. He's a busy man.
He's Carlton. Very busy, clearly.
Never gets a moment's rest, has he?
BBC Children in Need is back this Friday night, and it's gonna be a big one.
Oh, yeah.
With music from Lewis Capaldi.
Woo-hoo.
A mini apprentice special.
Go Wyatt!
The smallest gladiators around.
Please welcome Mini Diamond.
Do you want my autograph?
And loads more.
Wow.
Yeah.
Plus, meet the real stars of the night, the kids. Take it away, Mini Vernon Kay.
Cheers, Big Vernon Kay. Children in Need, tonight at 7 on BBC iPlayer.
Quick look at the weather now. Today it's going to be windy and wet across the south with heavy rain in places, mostly dry in the north with sunny spells.
On the way in the next half hour, the Conservatives are calling for a review of processes and procedures at the BBC after the corporation apologised to President Trump for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches on Panorama. We'll hear what they've got to say just after the headlines.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about the doctor's strike that begins today and about Saturday Night Live coming here to the UK. That is all after a summary of the news, read for us at, 29 minutes to 8 by Caroline Nichols.
Resident doctors in England are beginning a five-day strike over pay. Hospitals will come under the most strain, with resident doctors making up about half the medical workforce. NHS England said patients should still attend appointments unless advised otherwise. NHS bosses have warned that frontline staff or services may have to be cut because of the financial impact of the walkout. The BBC is waiting for a response from the White House after it apologised to President Trump for the way a Panorama episode edited a speech he gave on the day of the US Capitol riots in 2021. The BBC has rejected Mr. Trump's demand for compensation. The president and his lawyers have previously threatened a $1 billion lawsuit against the corporation. Russia has launched a large-scale missile and drone attack on the Ukrainian capital and other areas of the country. The mayor of Kyiv says at least three people have died and more than 20 have been injured. Critical infrastructure, a hospital and a school were targeted in the attack. In Russia, the military said it intercepted 200 Ukrainian drones that officials said had targeted industrial facilities and disrupted air travel. The County Councils Network is urging the government not to avoid reforms to the special educational needs system in England. Council leaders say it's facing total collapse and that rising demand for support will leave local authorities with a £4.4 billion annual deficit by 2029. The government has delayed planned changes until next year, insisting it wants to get them right. A rocket owned by the Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has successfully launched from Florida on its first flight for a paying customer. The Blue Origin rocket was carrying two NASA satellites bound for Mars, where they'll collect information about its climate. After takeoff, the booster touched down safely in the Atlantic, allowing it to be used again.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. 27 minutes to 8 now. Last night, the BBC replied to Donald Trump to say sorry for the misleading edit of his speech on the day of the Capitol riots, but to insist the corporation will not be compensating him, not giving him a penny. That news came as The Telegraph were publishing news that another BBC programme, Newsnight, had made another similarly misleading edit of the very same speech. So what should happen next? Roger Mosey joins us, former head of BBC Television News, also director of the London 2012 Olympic Games coverage. He had his own experience at that time of being threatened by Donald Trump. And we're going to be talking also to the Conservative Stuart Andrew, former culture minister, now shadow health secretary, at a time when the Tories have said they will withdraw support for the licence fee, unless, in their words, the BBC management show they are committed to impartiality. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Roger, first of all, has the BBC said the right thing in your view?
Yes, I think it has. And I think the important thing is this is currently a legal matter. And I would see it as being something where you are arrogantly legal in the way you handle it. And it's actually a risk if you play politics with it. And I think the BBC does seem to think it has a strong legal case, that principally nobody could see this in the US. And there was no damage anyway, in the sense that Trump got elected. So the BBC is right play it as a legal matter. And at the moment, I can't see why there would be a case for compensation. Of course, I'm not a lawyer.
In most cases where compensation has been paid by media companies in the United States, I think I am right in saying it has not been for legal reasons. It has been because those companies feared having damage to their relationship with the US administration, needed regulatory favours, or needed some sort of approval by the president. Do you think there are other dangers other than a legal compensation for the BBC?
Yes, I mean, I think at the moment there are two risks for the BBC. One is that it gives in and pays money which it has no need to do, which I think is arguably what happened with CBS in America, and that would be negligent. Or the other one is it fights a battle it's been told it would be likely to lose and wastes a load of money and has to pay compensation, and that would also be negligent. So the BBC has a tricky path here, but at the moment it seems the legal battle is as right as they can get it. And they do seem confident, and I think they're right to be confident, that they have a strong case.
And I mentioned your experience during the Olympic Games. You had a quite tricky call, I'm told, with Donald Trump's lawyers.
We were going to broadcast a programme just after the Olympics called You've Been Trumped, which was about Donald Trump and golf courses in Scotland. And it was going to be broadcast on a Sunday. And on the Friday evening, we got a humdinger of a legal letter from Donald Trump threatening to take us to Ofcom, the BBC Trust. We must not broadcast this programme. And I had the experience of going around a supermarket on Saturday morning with Donald Trump's lawyer from New York shouting at me about this programme. But we held firm on it because in the end, you've got to decide, is this a programme we should be able to broadcast or not? But it's very unpleasant when it happens to you personally. And this was a more trivial version of what's happening now. But when you are being demanded that the organisation demands you be sacked and you have Donald Trump attacking you personally.
But just in case there are other things up his sleeve, Roger, what if the word from the White House is, we'll ban your reporters from the White House. We won't allow them to travel with us. We will designate them as kind of unfriendly reporters. In the face of that sort of pressure, and I am speculating, we don't know that the White House are going to do that. What then?
Well, that's where, when I said the BBC should fight this at the moment as a legal battle, of course, Donald Trump is fighting it as a political battle. And I don't think the BBC should engage on those terms. But it is clearly possible for Donald Trump to take a lot of political sanctions against BBC, which would be regressible. But it could happen. And that, of course, and the root of this is the BBC did make a mistake. It did get something wrong. And therefore, you know, the president is entitled, I suppose, to take sanctions against that as he believes.
Well, let's pursue that thought with Stuart Andrew for the Conservatives. Good morning again to you, Mr. Andrew. Do you think the BBC, in this narrow regard, we'll come to the broader point in a second, is right to say no public money goes to Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, I would argue they shouldn't have got themselves in this position in the first place, frankly.
But now they are.
Well, now that they are, I mean, I'm glad they've issued the apology. Look, I am not a lawyer. This is a matter for the BBC, which is an independent organisation, to resolve with the president. But getting themselves in this position, not just once, but twice, shows that there are fundamental issues here that need addressing. Now, you know, when we had the fallout from the broadcasting from Glastonbury, I was the Shadow Culture Secretary at the time. We had a statement in Parliament. And in Parliament, I said, I've been a strong advocate of the BBC. I've been a strong supporter. But when things like this happen, it makes it harder for people like myself to feel that we can defend the BBC. And the Prescott report has said that there are fundamental issues here. And I'm afraid just two resignations is not going to cut it. We're going to have to see fundamental changes.
What does that mean? Give confidence. Sorry. What, wait, I hear you, and I know that in Parliament, your successor as Shadow Culture Secretary called for a full investigation into allegations of bias within BBC News. But, I mean, if you've had the head of news go, you've had the boss of the whole outfit, the chief executive, in effect, the director general, has also gone. What else is it that you want to see happen that would make a difference?
Well, I mean, I think there are things like BBC Arabic being brought under urgent control, for example, and we need to see that there is a full overhaul of US and Middle East coverage and be absolutely assured that any output is not actually being delivered by a sort of activist agenda. It has to be that independent reporting, that factual reporting, that in fairness, the BBC has done very well over many years.
Do you agree with the White House, the spokesman, who said in the last few days, the president has made it clear this is a, and I quote, leftist propaganda machine that is unfortunately subsidised by British taxpayers? Is that now the view of the Conservative Party?
Well, we want to have absolute confidence that the BBC gets back to what it used to do very brilliantly, which is deliver independent, factual reporting. And we feel that it's not right for licence fee payers to be forced into paying if they can't have that assurance.
Are you saying you could? Sorry, we're short of time.
The opportunity. I want the BBC to have the opportunity to sort this out once
Understood.
And for all.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to give you the chance to be really explicit about this. The licence fee, in effect, ends in 2027. It has to be renewed by Parliament under the Royal Charter. Are you saying we, the Conservatives, will not agree to that unless?
Well, what we've already said, Kemi wrote to the BBC to say exactly that, that we expect there to be fundamental changes. Otherwise, we are going to have to question whether it is right that the licence fee continues.
Okay,
this is an
Mr.
opportunity
Andrew.
Now for the BBC to get their house in order.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Stuart Andrew, and before him, Roger Mosey.
19 minutes to 8, Saturday Night Live has announced the creative team who will launch the show in the UK next year. The US version is a huge hit. It celebrated its 50th anniversary not long ago, and it's launched some of the biggest comedy and acting careers. So there is a real buzz around it coming here.
Night. Well, even after 50 years, there are still things about SNL that people don't know. So we are here to answer any questions people still have about the show. Yeah. Don't be shy. Just raise your hand. Yes, Quinta Brunson.
Hi. Hey.
Hi.
Hi. You ladies look great. Oh. What's your secret?
Wow. Thank you for asking that question we wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's discuss this a little more. That was Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, by the way, on the 50th anniversary programme. Scott Bryan's with us, TV critic, co-host of the Must Watch podcast on BBC Sounds. And Jolyon Rubinstein, who's a British actor and comedy writer, made several sketch shows, including BBC Three's BAFTA award-winning The Revolution, will be televised. Morning, both.
Morning.
Good morning.
I feel like, Scott, we should start with a small history lesson, which you can provide for us, because I hinted there about how significant Saturday Night Live or SNL is in the US. I mean, it is a big deal. When you look at the careers, the people who started on SNL and where they ended up, it's got a lot of weight behind it.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's an institution in the US. I think just the fact that it's been an incubator of new talent, but it's also just been kind of like a mainstay of satire in the US. I mean, it's live sketch comedy, sort of started, you know, on Monday with very little writing material. Then on Saturday, you're having to put a show together. It's sort of made and executive produced by Lorne Michaels, who is sort of coming over to the US to come and do it over here too. But it's also, I think, the fact that it is unpredictable. It is live. You have a live guest on the program too. So maybe somebody who's promoting a film or is sort of doing a musical performance. So even in an era of declining linear TV viewership, it is still a way to, I think, sort of get a lot of traction behind. You know, a lot of video clips can be shared online and it can certainly be viral. So for Sky to sort of pick it up and do their own version in the UK can make sense at some level. But it is also, I would say, quite a big risk. You know, the fact that it could not really find a viewership, but also the fact that it is going to be really rather costly.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, Jolyon, where will it sit in, you know, in and around what is already in the comedy landscape in the UK? Is there a place for it?
Hello, good morning. Well, look, as a huge fan of Saturday Night Live myself, you know, I'm talking the early sketches of Dan Aykroyd, you know, Eddie Murphy, you know, Will Ferrell breaking Adam Sandler. You know, there was real bite, real verve about Saturday Night Live. Super exciting. You've got to remember, it's been running since 1975. And yeah, I think that, you know, whenever you're creating or taking a format from one country into another, you know, there's always a risk. I mean, it's always fascinated me that it's only really in the last year that Have I Got News For You, which is one of our institutions, sort of seems to be bedding in through CNN of all people in the States. And I think that it has, you know, big shoes to fill because of that. But I think people are desperate for more satire. And I thought the point that was just made about its placement on Sky is very interesting, because satire's function is to punch up, you know, to speak truth to power. And, you know, we all hope it will be given the opportunity to do that on that broadcaster.
And what you said, Scott, as well, about it being broken down and going online. I mean, I think for a lot of people, certainly for me, my entire exposure to SNL as it exists now is clips I see online.
Yes, I mean, I think that will be part of their strategy. I mean, they announced quite recently, Sky, sort of some of the people involved in this sort of UK iteration, and like one person, James Longman, has had a lot of experience on US TV, including on The Late Late Show with James Corden. And of course, that was a show that had huge success because of Carpool Karaoke, which were when big A-list stars would be sharing a car ride with James. And of course, a lot of, you know, they know how to do good storytelling. So I think, you know, it's certainly, I wouldn't want to be too cynical before this show debuts. I think it all comes down to the fact of whether it has the confidence, but also whether the comedy is catered to UK tastes. Because in the US, the sketches can be quite long. The episodes can also last quite long, 90 minutes on a Saturday night. So I think it all comes down to, how can they take the ingredients that have made the US show so successful and tailor them specifically to a UK audience, and also sort of make it sure that it's rebellious enough to feel like something that you can really be a part of, particularly that you have to go out of your way to find it.
And just really briefly, Jolyon, it's worth saying that those huge names that you mentioned, they didn't go into Saturday Night Live as big names. And when the UK cast is eventually announced, it's presumably going to be something similar. People we might not know or might know a little about. And this might be the start of something bigger for them.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I know people who've been involved deeply in the process, and I know that they've been looking to put together, you know, a fresh ensemble of kind of exciting new talent rather than just the same regular faces. And we have seen with Jono being sort of taken on as the lead writer, you know, anyone who's enjoyed Year Friends or Sheep or even songs like Karate at Christmas, you know, will know the kind of absurdist stuff. I think what's interesting to me is, where's the bite going to be? You know, we're living in really profoundly powerful times. You know, we are a country that has Brass Eye, you know, the thick of it, Monty Python. You know, we're desperately in need. And I will say as well, because this is a section on the BBC, that I really hope that this encourages the BBC and Channel 4 to, you know, to provide the satire that is a fundamental part of our democracy and holding, you know, holding power to account.
Yeah. Jolyon Rubinstein, Scott Bryan, really good to talk to you both. Thank you.
It is now 13 minutes to 8. It is time for Thought for the Day. The speaker with us in the studio this morning is Daniel Greenberg, Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards and writer on Jewish law. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning. The UK Youth Parliament just held its annual debate in the House of Commons chamber. Permission to use the chamber is granted to the Youth Parliament uniquely because of the importance of encouraging and training the rising generation in the art of parliamentary debating. But what is that art? What are parliamentary debates really for? I asked a group of school students that question earlier this week, and their answer was that Parliament is a place for people to speak. But after discussion, they agreed that there are many other places, physical and online, where people are able to speak freely, and that the value of Parliament is less as a protected place for speaking and more as a protected space for listening. Parliamentary procedure is structured to encourage listening. For example, MPs are not generally called to speak in debates unless they were there at the start, and they are expected to stay after their own speech. And they're encouraged to take interventions to show that the purpose of debate is not just to state my opinion, but to refine it by listening to other perspectives. Judaism frequently challenges its adherents to understand the importance and difficulty of listening. In his translation of the Daily Prayer Book, the late Chief Rabbi Lord Sachs explains that the common Hebrew word Shema, the title of a core prayer, can be translated as to hear, which he says is purely passive, or as to listen, which he says is active and takes care, thought, and practice. In similar vein, the Talmud records an argument between two sages, Hillel and Shammai, about truth and falsehood in answering questions. The essence of Hillel's argument is that you cannot answer a question truly unless you have listened sufficiently carefully to the question to understand exactly what is being asked and why. The world today is full of people shouting at each other, physically or electronically. All too frequently, neither side appears to be listening to the other, and the purpose seems to be simply to create and inflame tensions by hurling slogans at each other's heads. If we want to reverse cycles of hostile tension, we need to look to our youth to give a lead, not in effective speaking or writing, but in sensitive listening and reading. So I hope the members of the Youth Parliament last week enjoyed their visit to Westminster and that they learnt something about how to speak, but much more about how to listen.
That was Thought for the Day with Daniel Greenberg, Parliamentary Commissioner for Standards. The time now is 10 to 8.
Hospital patients in England have been told that the NHS is hoping to carry out most of its planned treatment as resident doctors begin a five-day strike, their 13th since March 2023. They want a bigger pay rise than the government is offering. They say in real terms their pay is a fifth lower than it was in 2008. NHS leaders say the cost of the ongoing strikes is piling pressure on already stretched budgets and it could lead to permanent cuts in services. We'll hear from the BMA in just a moment. First of all, Nick Hume is Chief Executive Officer of the East Suffolk and North Essex NHS Foundation Trust. Good morning.
Good morning.
What impact is this having on patients at your trust?
Well, we've been able to minimise the impact on patients. So we've got to a position where we're running 99% of our elective of our operations and 97% of our outpatients. So although there will be disruption to some, we've managed to keep the disruption to an absolute minimum. We will, of course, have to reallocate staff in order to maintain that safe, high level of activity. And that will have an impact going forward. But for the next 5 days, as I say, the impact will be at a minimum.
And apparently you're seeing some resident doctors returning to work now and choosing not to observe the strike.
Yes, we are. We were just checking this morning with both hospitals to see what the numbers are, but we are seeing a higher number of people coming back. And I think it reflects a kind of changing mood music, both for other clinical staff, but also for our resident doctors, that I think their sense is that they are obviously frustrated in terms of the ongoing dispute, but I think they are voting with their feet and returning to work. We haven't got the absolute numbers yet, but I get the sense, and certainly in the last strike, we saw more people coming back than we've seen in previous industrial action.
Obviously, the pay settlement is something that is in the hands of the government. It's not something that you are involved in. But when you look at the arguments that resident doctors are making, do you think that they should be given more money?
I think that, you know, as you say, it's above my pay grade to talk about the pay, but other conditions we can impact on. So we are working very hard with our resident doctors across both hospitals, Ipswich and Colchester, to make sure that we provide the best possible working opportunities for them, to make sure that their rotas reflect, you know, reasonable rotas, and give them good notice, good advance notice of their rotas, making sure that we're not expecting them to travel. You know, the East of England is from Great Yarmouth to Watford, and so making sure that we can offer rotations, it means they don't have to travel great distances, and also to make sure that when they're at work, you know, they get good advance notice of their rotas. Their rotas, as I say, reflect their needs as well as obviously the needs of the service. So I think there's a lot that we can do as leaders in the NHS. I know that myself and my colleagues are really committed to do that. As I say, the pay is a matter for the BMA and government.
Just as a final brief thought, have you had to lose, as we suggested there, permanently lose any services as a result of the cost of these strikes?
No, we haven't. We've had to bear the cost because clearly if we're paying consultants to work differently and if we're paying consultants to work at a lower grade, we need to pay them additional money. So there is a cost involved, but it hasn't directly impacted the services that we provide.
Nick Hume, thank you for joining us this morning. Dr. Tom Dolphin is also with us, the BMA Council Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
The situation between you and the government at the moment has deteriorated. Are you anywhere close to a settlement?
We hoped that we might be getting into that direction. The Secretary of State appeared to be showing willing to move towards something that we thought might be more appropriate to reflect the situation, both on pay and on jobs as well. But unfortunately, we reached an impasse, which is why we're where we are now.
The Health Secretary spoke very strongly at the NHS Providers Conference earlier in the week. He said it's become increasingly clear that the BMA is no longer a professional voice for doctors. He's said that you're behaving like a cartel. He says you're threatening the future of the NHS, and that is a morally reprehensible position to be in. What is your response to that?
Those are very strong words. He feels strongly. That's for him to answer to. I think what's very clear for our members is that we've got a situation where we've got a dispute that's about pay and it's about jobs. We've got pay that is still a fifth down on the value that it had in 2008. Pay packets are still missing a fifth of their value. And we've also got thousands of doctors who are unable to get into training posts or unable to become the specialists and the GPs of the future that we need. And that's a serious situation that needs addressing. And I think perhaps Mr. Streeting is just frustrated. He's not able to mobilise the resources to address that desperate need for training posts.
And what about the millions of patients who will be listening to this morning and who will say times are hard for all of us, that the pay settlement that you're being offered is perhaps better than the pay settlement that they are being offered? How do you keep those people on side at a moment like this?
Well, when we look at pay over the last 15 years or so, since 2008, what we've seen is that for most people in the economy, pay has come back up to the value that it had in 2008. The graph has gone down, it's come back up again. For doctors, there's been a little bit of return, but we're still very much down on where we were before, and that's why the job isn't done. The Secretary of State said himself that pay restoration is a journey, not an event. And we were expecting there to be more steps on that journey. But in fact, next year they've suggested that we should be getting another real terms pay cut. So that's more pay erosion.
It's important to point out, though, that you do use a different method of inflation to most other people. And that's why your figures look different.
We think that the measure of inflation that we use reflects accurately the costs our members face. In particular, it includes housing, which CPI doesn't. And it also reflects the enormous student debts that people come out of medical school with.
You know, but it's also not the standard measure. And you talk about people across the country and you're saying that your pay is worse than theirs, but that's calculated on a different method. In actual fact, if you put it to the same method as everybody else's, the figures aren't quite what you're saying.
there's still a big gap. And there's also, importantly, a big gap between what we can earn in the UK and what doctors can earn in other countries like Ireland, Australia and Canada, where salaries can be two, sometimes more, times that what they are in the UK. And it's a global competitive market. We've got to make sure that we're investing in staff in the UK so we can retain them in the UK and provide specialists and GPs that people need.
Are you still talking to the Health Secretary, or have those talks broken down for the moment?
As is commonly the case during strike periods, but we are not currently in communication, but that's quite normal for a strike period, and we're hoping to pick up communication again once this period is over.
Because there's no sign of them ending, no?
Well, we want to negotiate. Okay, we want a settlement to this. We don't want to be on strike. We'd much rather be looking after the patients. That's what we went to medical school for. The Secretary of State needs to meet with us. Like, we need to come to a negotiated end to this dispute. He said himself when he was in opposition, you know, the power to end this dispute rests with the government and the Secretary of State. We agreed with him then, we agree with him now. And okay. I'm looking forward to meeting him soon.
Dr. Tom Dolphin, the BMA Council Chair, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Alex Forsyth joins us now for a word about tonight's Any Questions. Morning to you, Alex.
Hello, morning, Nick. Tonight we are in Watford, home of the famous football club with its famous former chairman, Sir Elton John. And there we will find out what people make of all that has been happening in Westminster and more widely this week. On the panel, we have the Skills Minister, Baroness Jackie Smith, the Shadow Minister for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, David Simmons, the Green Party peer and former leader, Baroness Natalie Bennett, and the journalist Kate Ferguson. We will be live at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4. I hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. There is a lot of weather around today, Simon King, isn't there?
There certainly is, Anna. Yeah, it's a very wet start to the day across England and Wales. Northern rain is coming in associated with Storm Claudia, and it's going to be affecting most of England and Wales today. But I just want to separate the southeast of England, because it's here actually where things will turn a bit drier. There'll be some sunny spells into the afternoon. But let's get on to the detail across the rest of England and Wales, and specifically where we've got these amber warnings from the Met Office. Reminder, these are the second highest level of warning they will issue, and that's for parts of South East Wales, East Wales, the Midlands and towards Eastern England. Widely, we could be looking at 40 to 80 millimetres of rain, but in the hills of South East Wales could be as much as 150 millimetres. So quite widely, I think many parts could see the whole month's worth of rain falling in the space of 24 hours. So the impacts of that will be, of course, some localised flooding, some travel disruption likely as well. There'll be a strong wind to go with it, especially towards parts of northwest England, northwest Wales, gusts of 60 or 70 miles an hour, and temperatures fairly irrelevant really, 12 to 16 degrees. Now, for Northern Ireland, it's quite cloudy this morning, some outbreaks of rain, but that is going to clear. There'll be some sunny spells this afternoon, highs of 7 to 9 degrees. For Scotland, it's been a chilly start, some frost in northern Scotland, some clear skies here, that'll bring some sunshine. In southern Scotland, a bit cloudier, some outbreaks of rain, that's going to clear, and temperatures getting to about 4 to 6 degrees. But the rain is going to continue for many across England, Wales overnight tonight, only gradually easing on Saturday across northern parts of England.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 14th of November. The headlines this morning: resident doctors in England have begun a five-day strike, despite warnings from NHS bosses that the cost of walkouts could threaten jobs and services. The BBC is waiting for Donald Trump's response after offering an apology for a misleading edit of one of his speeches, but rejecting his demand for damages. Where does this standoff go now? Where does it leave accusations of institutional bias against the corporation? The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, will join us in 10 minutes' time. And Russia has launched the biggest missile and drone attack for weeks on the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv.
Also coming up, we've been following the story of the British-Egyptian pro-democracy activist Alaa Abdel Fattah throughout his imprisonment in Egypt to the release 2 months ago. Now his family say he's being blocked from travelling back to the UK. His sister will join us live at 20 past eight. And robo-taxi self-driving cars hit the highways in the US. We've given one a go.
Heading to Daly City, City Hall. Please make sure your seatbelt is fastened.
And we're going to be talking about genetically engineered babies. How would it work, and can it ever be ethical? We'll discuss more about that before 9 o'clock, so please do stay with us. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Resident doctors in England are beginning a five-day walkout this morning, their second strike this year in a dispute over pay. NHS bosses have said frontline staff or services may have to be cut because of the financial impact. The doctors' union, the British Medical Association, has dismissed the warning as emotional blackmail. Our health editor Hugh Pym has the details.
Hospitals hope to carry out most of the planned treatment, but the NHS Confederation and NHS providers warn that thousands of patients could still have appointments and procedures cancelled. Trusts will redeploy senior doctors to prioritise emergency services. Employers say that the cost of the action, up to £300 million and similar to the previous strike, is not covered by the government, so will pile more pressure on constrained budgets and could lead to service cuts. The BMA said that the government could stop the strike with a new offer on jobs and on pay, compensating for past inflation. But ministers say doctors have had a nearly 29% increase over 3 years and that an offer of help on medical costs and a commitment to more jobs for newly qualified doctors was turned down.
Professor Meghna Pandit is a national medical director at NHS England and told us the strikes will have a huge impact.
Patients, procedures and clinics and operations which are planned for days and weeks and months, you know, can be rescheduled or cancelled. And these delays can cause harm. So we don't want that happening. It also has an impact on regular activities within hospitals, if you can imagine, that other staff having to cover those who are absent from work or striking.
The chair of the British Medical Association Council, Dr. Tom Dolphin, defended the position of union members.
We've got pay that is still a fifth down on the value that it had in 2008. Pay packets are still missing a fifth of their value. And we've also got thousands of doctors who are unable to get into training posts or unable to become the specialists and the GPs of the future that we need. And that's a serious situation that needs addressing.
There's been no response so far from President Trump after the BBC apologised to him for airing a misleading clip of one of his speeches but rejected his demand for compensation. In a statement last night, the BBC said the edit in a Panorama documentary had given the impression that he'd called for violence after losing the presidency to Joe Biden 5 years ago. It's written to Mr. Trump and his lawyers, who've threatened a $1 billion lawsuit. Here's our media editor, Katie Razzell.
Two letters, an apology, and a promise not to broadcast the Panorama again. But the BBC has told the president it will not be paying him compensation for editing together sections of a speech he made on the day of the Capitol Hill riots in January 2021. While the BBC sincerely regrets the manner in which the video clip was edited, said a spokesperson, we strongly disagree there is a basis for a defamation claim. The corporation pointed out to the president's legal team that it did not broadcast the programme on any US channels. It also said Donald Trump didn't suffer any harm as a result of the Panorama. He was elected president soon after it was broadcast. The ball is now in the president's court. The BBC is also examining a report that in 2022, 2 years before Panorama, an edition of Newsnight ran a similarly edited version of the speech, albeit with more context. This new revelation prompted an accusation from the president's legal team of a pattern of defamation by the BBC. The corporation said it rejected this.
Russia has launched a large-scale missile and drone attack on Ukraine. The mayor of the capital, Kiev, says at least three people have died there and more than 20 have been injured. Our correspondent, James Landale, reports from Kiev.
This was the most severe attack on Kiev for several weeks. Explosions could be seen and heard across the night sky as Russian missiles and drones competed with the capital's air defences. The emergency services said many people had been wounded and there were reports of several deaths. Pictures posted on social media showed direct hits on several high-rise apartment blocks. There was also damage caused by falling debris, with reports of fires in buildings across much of the city. Kiev's mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, described it as a massive enemy attack and warned supplies of power and water could be restricted. Public transport was also disrupted.
The Home Secretary will announce major reforms to the asylum system on Monday. Shabana Mahmood is expected to tell MPs that she will remove the incentives for migrants to come to the UK and deport more of those who are here illegally. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Shabana Mahmood claims the changes she will announce are the most sweeping reforms to tackle illegal migration in modern times. Less in, more out, is what she will tell MPs. The Home Office believes the UK has become the destination for asylum shoppers, those who shop around for different countries to claim refuge. Government sources said the numbers coming here are drawn by what they said was excessive generosity and the ease of remaining. The changes are modelled on Denmark, where the centre-left government has imposed one of Europe's strictest asylum systems. The Home Office has published figures that show nearly 50,000 illegal migrants have been removed or deported from the UK since Labour entered power. The Conservatives say the government is too weak to remove what they see as the biggest barrier to securing the borders, which is leaving the European Convention on Human Rights.
Council leaders are urging the government not to duck reforms to the special educational needs system in England, which they say is facing total collapse. The County Council's network says rising demand will leave local authorities with a £4.4 billion annual deficit by the end of this Parliament. The government has delayed planned changes until next year, saying it wants to get them right. Our political correspondent Alex Forsyth reports.
It's widely accepted that the special educational needs and disability system is buckling. With rising demand, parents often having to battle for support and budgets under huge strain. Council leaders in England are calling for billions in funding deficits to be written off, investment in specialist provision in mainstream schools, and changes to education, health and care plans, the legal documents that underpin a child's right to support. But many campaigners have warned against watering down legal protections for families. Some Labour MPs have warned ministers not to focus on cutting spending, pointing to the backlash over the government's attempt at welfare reform. The Department for Education said the government had already made progress with funding for more specialist school places and early intervention, and was listening to families and would continue engaging with parents.
The ban on landlords evicting tenants in England without providing a reason and going through the courts will come into force from May. It's one of the changes brought in by the Renters' Rights Act, which became law last month. The government says the move will provide more security for renters, but landlords and letting agents say it could ruin them. At least 30 schools in Australia and New Zealand have been closed after a warning about asbestos found in play sand imported from China. Both countries issued recall notices earlier this week. Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
On Wednesday, authorities in both New Zealand and Australia recalled several lines of decorative sand after laboratory testing detected traces of asbestos. Since then, dozens of learning centres in New Zealand, as well as close to 30 schools in Australia, have been closed as a precaution. Canberra saw the largest number of school closures, with the Australian Capital Territory's Education Minister explaining that the move would make it easier to test the sand, which had been used in some public schools for sensory play and arts and crafts. Elsewhere in Australia, New South Wales issued a safety alert, asking all public schools to remove the sand products if they had them. No schools were closed, though. Schools weren't closed in Victoria either. Authorities felt the health risk from using the product was low.
The Radio 2 presenter Sarah Cox is due to complete a gruelling challenge for the BBC Children in Need today, the equivalent of 5 marathons in 5 days. As our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson reports, this year's appeal reaches its climax tonight on BBC One and BBC iPlayer.
Knees are just so sore, though.
The final day of Sarah Cox's 135-mile Great Northern Marathon Challenge for Children in Need.
Don't be nice to me, I'll cry.
The aim, to be in Pudsey in West Yorkshire by the end of the afternoon, with Pudsey on her back.
Live music and fantastic presenters.
Tonight, Lenny Rush will be hosting the live show for the third year in a row.
It's just a time where we can all sort of come together as a country and just sort of raise awareness for such a great cause.
The 3 hours will include kids taking over The Apprentice.
Why is your name Lord Sugar when you are so salty all the time?
And there will be special versions of Strictly Come Dancing and Gladiators.
Colin Patterson reporting.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It is now 8:10. That child knows how to ask questions. Dear Donald Trump, we're sorry we made a mistake, but we won't be paying you any compensation. That, in summary, was the BBC's official response to the president's demand for $1 billion. It came after the revelation that Panorama had broadcast a misleading edit of his speech on the day rioters stormed the Capitol in Washington, D.C. in protest at what he and they claimed was the stolen election in 2020. Now, any hope that that might be the end of the dispute was dashed by another revelation by The Telegraph that 2 years earlier, Newsnight had also made and broadcast a similarly misleading edit of the same speech. All this comes as the BBC's future is in the balance. The licence fee is only guaranteed until 2027. What's called the BBC's Royal Charter has to be renewed then. The government is considering other funding options and the Conservative Party says it will withdraw support unless the BBC management show they're committed to impartiality. Important questions then for the minister in charge of the BBC, or at least of supervising it, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, Lisa Nandy, who joins us from Salford. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
Let's begin with the Trump letter, if we could, before we turn to wider issues. Was the BBC, in your view, right to both apologise and to refuse to pay any compensation?
Well, the BBC rightly guards its independence very fiercely, and so it's a question for the BBC board, the director and senior executives. But I can tell you that I've been working very closely with the BBC leadership. I've been speaking to the chairman and other senior leaders in the BBC daily over the last week, and I think they are treating this seriously. They have gripped it. They are right to apologise for what were serious mistakes, and they are right to have sought legal advice in order to respond robustly on that point. The most important thing that I think that they've done over the last week is to be very willing to own up to and apologise for serious mistakes that have been made, and to start work immediately on making sure that there aren't just the right processes at the top of the organisation, but there's also the right mix of journalistic experience to ensure that the highest editorial standards are upheld going forwards.
Let's come to that a little later, if we could. I just want to ask you whether your view would change if the president was to try to punish the BBC in other ways. Now, he has punished other news organisations that have upset him. He's banned their reporters, either from briefing or from flights. There's even speculation that Donald Trump could classify the BBC as a foreign agent by executive order, which would effectively shut down BBC operations in the United States. Would the government at that stage intervene?
Well, we haven't been asked to intervene by the BBC leadership, and I think that's for one very clear reason, which is that the BBC is independent of government, and in the forthcoming charter review, we'll be looking at how we can strengthen their independence from political interference even further. As I understand it, the BBC is still able to report freely in the United States, including at press conferences held at the White House. I had this discussion with senior leaders at the BBC yesterday. Obviously, if they need the government's help and they want the government's help, it is in their gift to ask for it. But I'm confident that the BBC is gripping this and is dealing with it and is still able to go about their daily business and to report in the United States as they can here in the United Kingdom without fear or favour.
You have praised the leadership for getting a grip, for owning up, for starting work on making change. Can I get your analysis, first of all? The charge that is frequently heard is that there is institutional bias at the BBC and that there is a culture of denial about the problem. Are those two charges, in your view, fair?
Well, I don't work for the BBC, and I think it's important that the chairman and the new director general are given the opportunity to speak for themselves. What I would say is that over the last 15, 16 months since we've been in government and I've been the culture secretary, I have expressed frustration on a number of occasions about the slowness of the leadership to deal with issues as they emerged, whether it was the workplace culture problems with Hugh Edwards and others, or it was the decision to broadcast documentaries from Gaza and the live feed at Glastonbury. In this instance, I do feel very confident that at the most senior level of the BBC, that these failures are being treated with the seriousness that they demand.
When you say at the most senior levels, there aren't any senior levels. The Director General's gone and the Director of News is gone. It is a vacuum at the top other than the Chairman at the moment.
Well, as you would expect, Nick, that's one of the things that would concern me if that were to be the case. And it's part of the discussions that I've been having. Obviously, the board remain in place with the chair of the board. The director general is still in post and will remain in post to see the organisation through the transition. And the deputy head of news is acting up in an interim position because it is essential that whoever is brought in as the new director general, she or he must have the ability to shape their own team and their own structures to make sure that those robust standards and that experience is there.
So they might not want new leadership in news, I think is what you're saying. You've talked also just a moment ago about getting the right mix, you said, of skills. Are you saying, as some have, that the next director general should be a journalist?
I'm not telling the BBC what to do because the BBC is independent, and so the board appoints the director general.
Sure, but what did you mean when you
said the right mix? Yeah, so having caveated that and just made that clear, I do think there is an emerging thread through many of the challenges that the BBC has had, some of which were raised by Michael Prescott in that email that was then leaked, where he raised serious concerns on a number of fronts. And that thread is that the editorial standards and guidelines that the BBC has are in some cases not robust enough and in other cases not consistently applied, which leaves individual journalists, presenters and editors in quite a difficult position on a number of occasions. I think that does demand that there are people at a very senior level with a journalistic background who are able to uphold those standards. The Director General, as you'll know, as set out in the Royal Charter, is the Editor-in-Chief. And so it's important that whatever structure the BBC board decides is the right one going forwards, that at a very high level you have somebody who is able to look with experience across those issues and make decisions about how to report on some of the most contested issues in the country, which all broadcasters are having to grapple with in the middle of culture wars. It's essential that the BBC has somebody with the experience and the skills to be able to do that.
Now, the last time there was a scandal at the BBC, there was a report into it. There were new structures set up, editorial standards committee of the board of the BBC. You were asked repeatedly in the House of Commons about one man's role on that, a member of the BBC board who, on the one hand, is attacked because he's a Conservative. He was director of communications for Theresa May. On the other hand, he was a person with an unblemished record as a BBC editor, editing political programmes and ensuring balance and impartiality there. The man in question is Sir Robbie Gibb. Do you think, from the outside, and as someone not of his politics, that he is doing his job, he is ensuring impartiality, posing questions to BBC News management, or do you think he's overstepping the line and actually weighing into politics?
I think that in particular is a question for the board and for the chairman of the board. I don't sit in those board meetings, and so I'm not in a position to be able to answer that. What I can say to you is that I think, given you talked about the sheer number of questions that I had on this in the House of Commons just this week, I think there is a real concern, which I share, that political appointments to the board of the BBC damaged confidence and trust in the BBC's impartiality. And that's something that we will be looking at as part of the charter review, which sets the terms of the BBC for the next decade and which this government is about to kick off.
In other words, you don't want the perception, you can't comment on the reality, it seems to me, the perception that a political campaign is being waged.
I think the perception is a problem. In the case of these four appointments, you mentioned one in particular. These were appointments that were made by the last government, and the one in particular that you mentioned, his term of office was renewed just weeks before the general election, and so he will remain in post until 2028. The charter sets out a very high legal test for the removal of any members of the board. They have to be unwilling, unfit, or unable to discharge their duties. size, and it also has to meet a rationality test in that you'd have to prove in a court of law that nobody of sound mind could have come to a different decision. That's the basis on which I told members of the House of Commons that in these particular instances, I'm unable to act. But what I can do is look at all of this through the charter review process, and
understood.
I intend to do so.
Let us broaden this out, because in defence of Sir Robbie Gibb, Michael Gove is quoted, and I'm saying this because it's not fair to talk about an individual who can't comment for themselves. Michael Gove, the editor of The Spectator, now former Conservative Cabinet Minister, is in the Financial Times saying, look, this guy believes in the BBC, but he thinks, and I paraphrase, it could be doomed as an organisation if it loses the confidence of vast swathes of people, not exclusively on the right of politics, but in particular on the right of politics. Do you think, in a sense, that warning is right, that if the consensus behind the BBC breaks, whatever your politics, that is a serious problem?
Yes, I agree with the way that Michael Gove has characterised that. I think the BBC has to be open to challenge and has to be able to respond and respond quickly when mistakes are made. I've seen that from the BBC leadership this week. I've been critical when I haven't seen that previously. But I would just caution against the sort of overwhelming narrative that lies behind that statement, because the BBC is and remains the most trusted source of news in this country and one of the top five most trusted sources of news all over the world. It is a light on the hill for people in times of darkness. And it is one of the only shared spaces and places that brings this country together on multiple occasions, whether it's through traitors or the VE commemorations, these great national events. Nobody does it better than the BBC. So I think we need to be careful here about somehow creating the sense that the public don't support the BBC. The public do support the BBC, and that's why Michael Gove is right to say that where they make mistakes, they must be willing and able to respond to that level of challenge and to put in place changes, because that trust is something that is essential, it's vital, it's precious, and it must be protected.
Finally, Secretary of State, does that mean then that this Labour government, with a very large majority, is willing to back a continuing licence fee, even if it has to be amended and topped up in other ways, in the face of political opponents who will either say, in the case of reform, we want it abolished altogether, or might, in the case of the Conservatives who are still considering their position on this, say, we want it substantially cut?
We're not opposed to the licence fee in principle. I think the licence fee has an important principle behind it, which is that households across the UK pay for their national broadcaster and are therefore invested in its future. What the licence fee also does is guard from political interference, which is one of the reasons why we've ruled out general taxation. It's the only thing we've ruled out, because the independence of the BBC is paramount and it must be able to scrutinise us as a government and any other government without fear or favour. We're looking at the broadest range of options and we haven't made any decisions about that, but we'll keep an open mind. We're not opposed to the licence fee per se, although there have been challenges with its enforcement and the way that enforcement action has been targeted on particular groups. But we'll keep an open mind. We'll start a public conversation. It's the people's BBC and they must have a role in shaping its future.
So in a sentence, you grew up in a family that worked in television, that believed in news and current affairs, that committed much of their adult lives to it. You think this rather unique arrangement that we have in Britain can continue, that it is not doomed?
I think, as someone, as you rightly say, Nick, who comes from a background where members of my family were deeply involved in upholding the integrity and independence of broadcasting and holding power to account, I think that if the BBC didn't exist right now, we'd be trying to invent it. It's the envy of the world. And despite the very serious mistakes that have been made in recent days, it's our intention as a government through the Charter Review to set it on a firm footing, not just so that it can thrive for the next decade, but well into the latter half of this century.
Lisa Nandy, Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
It is 24 minutes past eight now. Alaa Abdel Fattah, the British-Egyptian pro-democracy activist who was finally freed from prison in Cairo in September, has been blocked from travelling home to the UK. He was Egypt's best-known political prisoner, and we followed his story here on the programme, including bringing you the first interview with Alaa after his release from detention.
For the most part, like most of the past 12 years I've been there, And so I missed that my 30s. So I'm now in my mid-40s, and I need to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. So that's I'm still committed to a fight and a struggle for a better world. But what this means and what shape it's going to take and so on, I don't know. It's the contact point with my family that was just relief, like that my mother, that I don't need to worry about my mother anymore. And also that now we are actually to be able to be there together and also to enjoy the small things, which are the big things, you know.
Now, Alla was due to be flying to London to receive a prestigious campaigning award last night, but wasn't allowed through the airport in Cairo to board the plane and fly to the UK. Sana Saif is Alla's sister, a regular voice on the programme. Sana, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. What happened when Alla went to the airport?
We checked in and everything, and then we waited at passport control and security office for a while. I mean, I was about to miss my flight, and then at some point they told me I need to figure out, probably Alla will not make it to the flight, and I need to figure out whether I'm going to be on the flight or not. They didn't explain much. Our lawyers in Egypt are trying to understand, like, the legal grounds. But yeah, they blocked him from boarding the flight, and I had to go alone.
And there's no reason for that to have happened, because Alla has, he has British citizenship, he has a passport, he has everything that he needed, and he should have been allowed to fly.
Yes, he has a British passport, and also we managed to renew his Egyptian passport in case they needed it. That's why we assumed, like, after the renewal of the Egyptian passport that that he would be allowed. I just want to remind people that Alla's son lives here, I mean, in Brighton. We're really glad to have him back in our life, partially free, but he needs to have freedom of movement to live with his son, be reunited with him, like, properly.
Yeah, so as we said, he's no longer in detention, but if he can't leave the country, that is not the full freedom that he was expecting and that he should have had.
Yes, exactly. And, I mean, a big part of, like, the motivation for this was to bring Khaled, his father, back. Khaled, we managed to give him, to get, like, a break from school, and he went to Cairo, so he did, like, have a lovely time with Alla, and they went swimming together, and he stayed a month in Cairo. But Khaled needs his father, and my nephew is on the spectrum. He has autism, and he's very, very comfortable in his school and his setup in Brighton. And we can't change. We can't keep, like, creating instability. We just need his father to be able to be with him.
And Alla, in that interview, when we spoke to him after he was released, he was talking about how much he was looking forward to being at home with Khaled and all the things that they would do together. And so as things stand at the moment, you have not been given a clear reason by the Egyptian authorities as to why this has happened. They haven't given you a proper explanation.
Sadly, no, not yet. Lawyers are trying to inquire, but we don't understand the legal grounds of it. But I'm hopeful that, I mean, the hard part is over. Alla is free, so I'm hopeful that this can be resolved. Quickly.
And we have a statement from the Foreign Office, which I'll read in just a second. But in terms of your communication with them, are they continuing to support you in trying to get this sorted out?
I hope so, yes. The Foreign Office have been communicating. I'd like to urge the PM's office to, have their attention again for a second until we get this done. I'm not sure what they are doing about it, but I'm hoping everyone is working hard to bring Alla here.
Yeah. Sana Saif, thank you for joining us. That statement that I said that we've received from the FCDO says President Sisi's decision to pardon and release Alla Abdel Fattah was extremely welcome news and a significant step forward. We continue to press for his urgent return to the UK at the highest levels with the Egyptian government so he can be reunited with his family. The case remains a priority issue for the UK government.
It's just coming up to 8:30. Here's Carthy with the sport.
Morning, Nick. Thank you very much. Headlines from last night's World Cup qualifiers. First, and England had already qualified for next summer's tournament, but they beat Serbia 2-0 to maintain their 100% record in this campaign. There was an excellent win for the Republic of Ireland, a 2-0 victory over Portugal. And Northern Ireland are in third place in qualifying Group A. They are away at Slovakia tonight. Now, the Cheltenham November meeting begins today, and being inducted into the Jump Racing Hall of Fame at Cheltenham is Rachel Blackmore, the first female jockey to win the Cheltenham Gold Cup and also to win the Grand National. Morning, Rachel.
Good morning. How are we?
Hello. Very well, thank you. I hope you are. You retired in May this year. Is this the first time you are going to be back at the races as a non-rider? Perhaps a strange day ahead?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be very strange walking through the gates of Cheltenham and not heading for the weigh room. But I'm, delighted to be back. So it's going to be my first day back jumps racing in Ireland or England. I'm delighted to be back today and to be working with the Jockey Club.
Yeah, you're being inducted into the Hall of Fame alongside the likes of AP McCoy, Ruby Walsh. What does that mean to you?
It's just such an incredible honour. Like, when you never really think that something like that is going to happen when you're riding. And yeah, just to be given that honour, to be on the list of names of incredible equine athletes and human athletes and people involved in our sport, it's just extremely special.
Yeah, I mean, what you did was extremely special, becoming the first female jockey to win the Cheltenham Gold Cup, the first female jockey to win the Grand National. Has there been something of a decline in numbers in the Cheltenham Festival in the last couple of years? The November meeting crowd, though, is increasing. On average, only a quarter of spectators at that Cheltenham racecourse are women. I think you've just been made the head of Ladies' Day for the next Cheltenham Festival this week. What do you think are the reasons behind those numbers being so low compared to some of the other races?
Yeah, so it's definitely an issue. You know, as you said, only 25% of the ticket sales over the 4 days of the festival are female. So Cheltenham Racecourse are now making a concerted effort to try and make the festival appealing to everyone. They've reintroduced Ladies' Day on the Wednesday. And I'm going to be part of the team now that's going to try and figure out what all those issues are. So I'm going to be exploring what a race day is like not being in the weigh room. So that's obviously going to be very different for me. But, you know, I'm looking forward to chatting to race goers and kind of finding out, you know, maybe what are the issues and why women aren't feeling like a day at the races is something that they want to go to. But, you know, I know from my own friends who go, they have an unbelievably good day. You know, I definitely wouldn't have been tempted to go out and join them when I was riding because they're having way too much fun. So, it's Cheltenham is just a fantastic place. It's like the pinnacle of our sport. Nothing feels like Cheltenham. And it's just something that I would love. I'd love to see more women coming racing and enjoying the day out. We're going to try and work with Cheltenham now to try and tackle what those issues are and make things a whole lot better.
Yeah, I'd be very interested in you coming back to talk to us when you have had a look at some of those issues and worked out the reason, because a quarter of spectators is quite a surprise. I did wonder if animal welfare and the perceived cruelty, if they are factors in putting, obviously, people off, but particularly women, perhaps, is enough being done to change those concerns?
Yeah, I think, look, I've been around horses all my life and I know how they're cared for. I know the lengths that are gone to try and make racing as safe as possible. You know, look, you can never eliminate risk. It's a sport. You can never eliminate risk, but there is so much done in order to look after the horses and their welfare. It's absolutely paramount. And horses have given me the best days of my life, and I definitely wouldn't want to be involved in anything where they weren't the most important thing on a day's racing, and they are. So I'm very confident in that everything has been done, to keep racing as safe as we can.
And in this November meeting, on the Today programme, we do racing tips for big meetings, which this is. Could you perhaps give us a racing tip for Cheltenham?
Yeah, so jockeys are renowned to be the worst tipsters, but I'm not a jockey anymore, so maybe my
best
luck will change. There's obviously Henry de Bromhead is the trainer who I would have had most of my success for in Cheltenham. He's an incredible Irish trainer, and when he brings his horses to Cheltenham, they seem to just improve again. So he's two horses running. He's a couple of horses running over the next 2 days, but he's one today and one tomorrow. The one today I like is a horse called King's Bucks, who runs in the Grade 2 Novice Hurdle. So I really like him. He's stepping up in trip. I think that'll help him a lot. And he's a bit of a bigger price, so that might be a nice each way one. And then tomorrow, a mare called July Flower. So she won her first race over fences the last day in Limerick. And she was definitely one that made me miss riding when I was watching her because she looked electric. So she runs tomorrow. And yeah, I think she'll run a very big race as well.
Thank you very much for both of those. Appreciate you coming on and enjoy your induction day at Cheltenham. Rachel
thank
Blackmore,
you so
thank
much.
You. Just to mention that Rory McIlroy is two shots off the lead after the first round of golf's end of season DP World Tour Championship, and Carlos Alcaraz has become the new tennis men's world number one at the end of the season.
Thank you, Carthy. Let us find out who Lauren Laverne's chatting with this morning.
My castaway, getting ready to go to the island this week, is the photographer Sally Mann.
I wanted to be a poet, but back then you couldn't earn a living as a poet. So the only other thing I was good at was photography, and I had to earn a living, so that's what I did.
So what kind of pictures were you taking?
I worked for a university, so I was doing all the headshots for the football team and the grip and grin ones where someone gives a check to the university and there's a handshake and the most boring, miserable work you've ever imagined, but that's how I got good.
Sally Mann, My Castaway on Desert Island Discs, this morning at 9.
Quick look at the weather now. Windy and wet across the south, heavy rain in places, mostly dry in the north with sunny spells.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson in London and Anna Foster in Salford. It is 24 minutes to 9. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Resident doctors in England have begun a five-day strike over pay. NHS bosses say frontline staff or services may have to be cut because of the financial impact of the walkout. The BBC is waiting for a response from the White House after it apologised to President Trump for the way a Panorama documentary edited a speech he gave on the day of the US Capitol riots in 2021. The corporation has rejected Mr Trump's demand for compensation. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, told this programme that she believed the BBC was right to apologise for what she called a serious mistake. Russia has launched a large-scale missile and drone attack on Ukraine. President Zelensky says four people have been killed. The Home Secretary will announce major reforms to the asylum system on Monday. Shabana Mahmood is expected to tell MPs that she'll remove the incentives for migrants to come to the UK and deport more of those here illegally.
Thank you, Caroline. 23 minutes to 9. Sara Sharif, who was murdered by her father and stepmother at the age of just 10 after suffering horrific abuse, was failed repeatedly by the authorities in the months before her death. An independent review of the case has found that council staff went to the wrong address when they tried to check on her. An inexperienced social worker produced a report that was missing vital details about her life and about the risks that she faced from her own family. And bruising that was spotted on her face at school was not properly followed up. The system failed to keep her safe, found the report's authors. Surrey County Council says it is deeply sorry for that. Well, Sir Mark Headley joins us, Family Court Judge, Justice of the High Court between 2002 and 2013. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
There was one decision in all of this which was also highlighted, that a family court judge in 2019 gave custody of Sara to her father despite him having a history of violence, arrests for assaults on three women and on his own children. And people will look and wonder how something like that could happen.
Well, I think that those were private family law proceedings where the court has no power to put a child into care. And therefore, the judge would have had very limited scope as to what she could do. All she could actually do would have been to report the case to the local authority under Section 37 of the Children Act and ask them to investigate.
It sounds like one of those moments where the law, and I realise that the law is a complicated and often archaic thing, but the law in this case doesn't seem to have worked to protect a child the way it should have done.
Well, because we know the end result, it's very difficult to look fairly at what actually happened at the time, because that was a case, that was the moment when the court was not given the information that the inexperienced social worker should have given to the court. But before the Children Act, there were 10 ways of getting into care, all sorts of different thresholds and different criteria. And a political decision, widely supported, was taken that there should only be one route into care, namely on the application of a local authority, which is what the law is at the moment. So the judge simply didn't have the power to deal with the matter then. The the fundamental problem in this case is the, yet again, we have another story of failure of professionals to talk to each other and communicate with each other. We've got all the right procedures. It's just that we're not good at making them work.
I mean, that's a good point. People will remember names and they will remember faces of children who have been through, as you say, appalling situations exactly like this. And things don't always change. I mean, when a failing like this is highlighted, when, as you explained, the judge did not have access to what they needed and the decision making was limited in terms of what was available to them, should that provoke a change?
Well, I think, I mean, that at the end of the day is obviously a political decision rather than a lawyer's decision. The difficulty is, our experience has shown that hard cases make bad law, and it's usually very unwise to change the law as a result of one thing having happened, because of all the implications for all sorts of other cases down the line. Sadly, domestic violence is the stock in trade of the family judge these days. You can hardly sit for a day without encountering it. And it's not always easy to judge quite where that domestic violence is liable to end up. Vast majority of parents don't kill their children. And these judgments are often extremely difficult to make, which is why communication is so important, because if the judge hasn't got the information, well, then clearly errors are going to be made.
What about the huge pressure that the court system is under, the delays, the amount of time that things take, and looking at the family court system specifically? Now, that wasn't necessarily mentioned as being a factor in this case, but it can't be a helpful element when cases like this are going on all the time.
I mean, that of course is true. The trouble with family justice is that it's a need-driven system. You can't say, well, we'll only take X number of cases in a year. You have to take everything that there is. And as pressure builds up and pressure on families builds up, so the demands on the family court build up. And so we are at a position where the system, whilst not overwhelmed, is certainly at very full stretch, as I think the president has often tried to point out. And that of course is a problem. That's when mistakes can be made and information isn't passed around. But I do think the fundamental of this report is a reminder yet again of the importance of professionals passing proper information to each other. Almost every public inquiry in the last 20 years has drawn attention to this. We know what we have to do. We even know how to do it. We just don't seem to be very good at actually doing it.
Sir Mark Headley, former High Court Justice, thank you for joining us.
It is now 17 minutes to nine. The markets have moved on that report that we brought to you earlier, first in the Financial Times, that the government has changed its mind about increasing income tax in the Chancellor's budget. Rachel Reeve had given the strongest hint possible that that's what she was going to do. The Treasury had not disputed those reports. Now the FT says the idea has been scrapped. Faisal Islam is watching the markets and they're not happy, Faisal.
Yeah, we saw quite a significant uptick, a spike, I think I'd probably call it, in the sort of benchmark measure of UK government borrowing costs, the 10-year gilt. So that's a sort of loan over 10 years. It went up 0.12%, what we call 11-12 basis points. That's quite a large increase. That has sort of come down a little bit, actually, as we speak. That increase sort of halved. We did actually have a statement from the Treasury. We do not comment on speculation around changes to tax outside of fiscal events. The Chancellor will deliver a budget that takes fair choices to build strong foundations, the usual sort of sentence.
Yeah, just to be clear to people, though, this word speculation often sounds like, you know, some reporter in a dirty Mac in a pub picks up a bit of gossip. The FT doesn't report stuff like that, does it? The Treasury has to send its proposals for budget measures to the Office for Budget Responsibility, and it can change its mind. It's a process that happens over a week or two. And what they've got information of is that the official information sent to the OBR has changed.
Yes. So I think this goes back to the sort of pitch rolling speeches that we reported a couple of weeks ago from the Chancellor. And I think one interpretation of that was that, yes, they had put in an initial sort of take that there would be those income tax rate changes. I think the way I saw that always was that the option was being prepared for some sort of manifesto busting tax income tax rise. This has always been what they call an iterative process. There's a sort of ping pong between the Treasury and the OBR. That's absolutely normal. We've seen it under previous chancellors, under Conservative chancellors. They test out options. They work out how much it would cost. They work out who would it impact, and then they potentially alter them. So there's a, so how strong was the commitment to doing this policy in the first place? Was it an option? I was always sceptical that it was a definite thing that they were going to do. And now what the FT had reported is that in the latest iteration that's gone to the OBR, that that idea has been dropped and replaced with some other idea. I think the other thing to say is that there's a number of other potential policies that were the kites were flown, things like tax on partnership income, things like this exit tax on entrepreneurs to capture those people who leave the UK, change domicile. And those in various other newspaper reports, which would have raised billions of pounds, have also been taken back. So I think it's quite ironic, really, that earlier in the week we were hearing political speculation about people in Downing Street saying it's only number 10 and number 11 current inhabitants that can sort of keep the markets in check. I think what we're seeing now is the sort of constant kite flying and uncertainty over policy. While the markets have, I mean, we would say that there is a response there. I have to say, as I speak, that the increase we saw at the beginning of trading, which was, I said, 10 to 11 basis points, which is notable, has gone down to 5.
Okay.
So maybe that statement has slightly sort calmed things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, markets want certainty, but they also want a sense of direction. And they did, whether the people out there think that it's the right economic policy for the country or not, they liked the commitment to fiscal consolidation that was embedded by the idea that they take very tough political decisions.
Final quick one, Faisal. For people listening who are not worried about the markets but are worried about what tax they're paying, if they don't pay more in income tax rates, they still might pay a lot more in income tax because they can change the thresholds, can't they?
Well, this is the great irony. You know, officially, the Conservatives under the last government kept to their tax, most of their tax promises. But because of the threshold freeze, we had the single biggest tax rise, I think, for 30 or 40 years. It was a 50 billion a year tax rise. So there is something of an illusion going on here about these promises. But the now Labour government chose to make these promises on rates. And it does seem as if the voters notice less what happens with thresholds. There's a sort of incentive for governments to do this. But yes, the tax they pay is very real, even if the rate goes up when they change thresholds. That was just from a freeze. The speculation floating around now is that thresholds would have to go down, which would capture even more people in higher bands of income tax. I think many people would actually notice that, even if the rates don't go up.
Thank you very much indeed. We'll keep watching the markets for you.
It's 12 minutes to 9. The food programme here on Radio 4 has been investigating our growing dependence on West Africa for fresh vegetables. In fact, almost 100% of things like sweet corn, radishes, spring onions and peppers that are sold in the UK between now and the summer will have come from there, specifically from northern Senegal near the border with Mauritania. Dan Saladino is a food journalist, presenter of the food programme. Morning, Dan.
Good morning, Anna.
This is one of those stories that I hear and I genuinely think, I didn't know that. I had no idea.
Same with me, because what I didn't realise, one of the most surprising facts when we did this investigation was the love affair Britain has with corn on the cob. 20 years ago, we were eating 25 million pieces of corn on the cob. Today, it's 160 million pieces of corn on the cob. And part of this story is about a supply chain from northern Senegal, which enables those corn on the cobs to be arriving 52 weeks a year, whatever the season. And it's the most unlikely part of the world because it's just south of the Sahara and Mauritania. Look around and it's desert, but there's a river, a lake, and a network of canals. And that's the location where two British farms, Gees and Barfoot's, and these are companies that take on the responsibility of supplying supermarkets with fresh produce 52 weeks a year. They have two farms. One is 1,500 hectares of sweet corn. That's around 2,000 football pitches, 7,000 workers. And this is a part of West Africa which is attracting lots of businesses from different parts of the world to grow food, from Europe, from the Middle East, from Asia. And to the east is...
I was just wondering, Dan, because obviously we talk so much about food miles, don't we? And to bring all of that produce here to the UK, it's got an environmental cost, it's got an economic cost as well. I'm just wondering where the balance is, because presumably they have a workforce, they have the ability to, you know, to actually use a lot more land than perhaps they would in the UK.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the question we're posing in the programme. Is this a good thing? We have seen many years in which we've reduced air freight. So some fresh produce still arrives by air freight from East Africa. In this case, one of the attractions of West Africa is it's 6 days by container ship. So the argument from the companies is that it's a lower carbon footprint, 6 days by sea. The quality of the produce, they argue, is better as well. And yeah, one of the big factors is that this is an area where there are a lot of young people unemployed, and in an era in which USAID and the UK has been reducing its aid budget as well, the companies argue that their presence is helping to build schools, build hospitals. They've created an infrastructure in which Senegalese farmers can grow food for the domestic market. And yet we did speak to workers who were saying, you know, this is tough agricultural work. The pay is relatively low, and you could argue we are the beneficiaries of that lower or that cheaper workforce, providing us with cheap food 52 weeks of the year. So in the program, we've been asking that question: is this a good thing or a bad thing, and should we be more dependent on West Africa when certainly climate in that region has caused problems for coffee growing, cacao growing? Is there risk?
There's a lot of layers, isn't there? It's really interesting. It's a fascinating question. Thank you, Dan. More on that story then on the food programme at 11 here on Radio 4.
Let's look ahead to what's happening on Radio 4. Now, we're going to do that a little bit later. We're going to talk instead now about robo-taxis. Waymo has become the first robo-taxi provider in the US to offer driverless rides on highways across San Francisco, Los Angeles and Phoenix, Arizona. It says it'll give them a better chance of competing with ride-hailing companies and traditional taxi services. The BBC's tech reporter, Lily Jamali, went to give it a go.
I am jumping into a Waymo here in downtown San Francisco that will take me down to the next town south of here. Let's see if I can get in. I have to hit a button on the app that says unlock, check, and the little banner on the top says LJ for my initials. Good evening. I'm gonna put my seatbelt on and I will say start ride. There's a button that I can use on my app or in the car, so I've just hit it.
Vehicle approaching. Heading to Daly City, City Hall. Please make sure your seatbelt is fastened. For any questions, press the call support button to speak with a rider support agent.
On Wednesday, the company said that it would start offering rides in its robo-taxis on the freeways. And this is a pretty big moment for the company, which has, up until now, only ferried passengers on city streets here in the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as in Los Angeles and Phoenix, Arizona. I got to actually ask a couple of people on the streets of San Francisco on Market Street what they think about this development.
I mean, to me, it's a good thing because I don't have a car. And I don't have to talk to anybody, so that's also a point.
I don't like the concept at all. I guess they're as safe as a distracted driver, but I don't like the idea of technology taking more jobs and there being no accountability for a car with no driver in it.
It's definitely an interesting experience, someone not driving or not being there, but they're slow, if that means anything. Uber drivers can whip around.
To be clear, the vehicle that I'm in right now does not have a human safety driver in case anything goes wrong. Company officials have been saying that this step towards ferrying passengers on the freeway has been a long time in the making. So it looks like this Waymo will not take me on the freeway because freeway access is limited right now, according to the company. So not all riders get access to these newly rolled out freeway trips right away. They say they're doing this gradually, adding more and more riders as they go along. And basically, if you want to be able to access those kinds of rides, you've got to get on this wait list.
Let us turn now at 9:05 to a rather interesting game going on in our schools. A game that involves pupils and teachers and AI. Some pupils do their own homework, as ever. Some ask AI to do it for them. But then teachers can also use AI in the form of what's called an AI detection app to try to work out whether the pupil's done their own homework or not. All very complicated. Two people are familiar with this. Join us now, Becky Arnold, head of Framingham Earl High School near Norwich, and Daniel Tagg, science teacher and quality improvement at South Devon College. Morning to you both.
Good morning. Well,
Becky Arnold, first of all, do you feel you're in this sort of game in which you're trying to keep up with what kids at the school are doing?
Absolutely. You know, the kids are far more savvy to this than we are as teachers, and they're far more experimental with what they are doing. So as a staff body, we are doing all that we can to make sure that homework is still valid, assessments are still valid, and we're just thinking how to reframe those. So actually we can use AI beneficially. You know, AI is here to stay. So we need to think about actually how can we teach the children to use it in a way which isn't going to stop them from learning. You know, we genuinely want them to be deep and critical thinkers, but we also need them to use AI responsibly. So we're reframing how we do assessments and homework so that they can use AI, maybe find me 10 great quotes for this essay, but then they write the essay in class with the teacher supervising them.
It's quite a challenge, this, Daniel Tagg, isn't there? Because there is a new, yet another AI app called an AI Humaniser that allows pupils to use AI to write the essay, but then to sort of jumble it up a bit so it feels more human. Now, we've just done an experiment with an essay which, written by AI, the AI content detector said 80% of it had been AI generated. It was, in fact, 100%, but it spotted that. When it went through an AI Humaniser app, that figure more than halved. In other words, AI is very good at detecting what it's up to.
Yeah, you're
disguising
correct.
What it's up to, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've received some excellent guidance from a joint information systems committee, and various institutions will use certain AI checkers. I'm trying not to mention a specific company, but Turnitin, and they simply don't work. But kind of mirroring what Becky has said, you know, teachers are extremely adaptable, and we've learned very quickly to reframe these assessments. One could argue that students have kind of cheated on their homework for a long time, you know, through the use of a rather keen parent. So there is certainly a game, but I would say that as educators, we are doing rather well, and I know for myself here at South Devon College, I'd say we're kind of ahead of the curve. We're very much experimenting with the certain technologies and allowing students to be part of the debate.
And you feel, do you, Becky, that there's a net positive despite all this challenge, all this gaming?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that if we think about what we want the children to be able to do going forward, we want them to be able to use the tools that are out there. You know, years ago when I first started teaching, copy and paste was the thing. You know, kids would go on to Google, they'd copy and paste an answer and they'd put it on. And we had to think, well, actually, it's great that they can access this information without going to a library or having a household full of encyclopedias. But how are we going to harness it so that we're getting them to think rather than just collect the information? So it's definitely something that we need to be doing.
Quick last word from you, Daniel. That's the positive, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll echo Becky's thoughts. It's such a powerful tool. It's really going to support our learners, and we should embrace it.
Daniel Tagg from South Devon College, Becky Arnold from Framingham Earl High Street near Norwich. Anna, do you use AI? I tried to use it to plan an interview the other day. It was absolutely okay.